If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
We are live with a new, completely unnecessary podcast.
Is that ever not new?
They usually are. For Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, alongside my compadre, Ian Ferguson.
Howdy.
My name is Pat Contry. We got a fun-filled and fact-filled adventure tonight for you. I don't know about fact-filled, but it's going to be a fun podcast. We're covering lots of stuff. Walmart getting into the used video game market. Koji Igarashi leaving Konami. We're going to talk about video game collecting burnout. We'll be doing a little mini review, talk about the iPhone/Droid game Calculords by Sean Baby. Latest WWE developments and your Q&A and maybe a couple other topics. And also, we're going to be talking about auction psychology in regards to a recent Steam Events auction that just ended today. So, Ian, how's everything going on in your neck of the woods?
Good. We actually started planning things that would happen for the wedding back in Buffalo.
Oh, cool.
I have to split up into two separate
things. You're going to split the wedding like this podcast is split.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Why don't you just do it over Skype? You can do
that'll be...
Or you stream it. You stream the wedding. We'll do the marathon.
That'll be a good fucking time. No, but I think we're going to rent out a whole trail of cabins, and all my family and friends are just going to drink and hang out in the woods for a night. That would be Buffalo, so that's pretty cool.
Oh, very cool.
And I have music gear coming my way on Friday, which means I'm a giddy guy, and getting to Friday night is going to be extremely hard to do. But other than that, you know, work, reading, watching old wrestling.
WWE Network, you're just not stopping with that?
No, I mean, I'll put it, it makes great background noise. Like, I'll turn on something that I don't really want to watch, and then, you know, I'll be writing or I'll read or something like that, and I'll, you know, look up and watch someone, you know, pull off a sloppy suplex and, you know, go back to what I was doing.
What's a sloppy suplex?
That looks like shit.
One that doesn't ever get vertical, just kind of wobbles the legs.
Right,
the
yeah, yeah.
You gotta help them out. You definitely gotta help them out. What's been going on with me? I promised it from the last podcast, and I got out before this one, a new Pat the NES Punk episode. Random Famicom fun. Woo! I'm excited. You're so excited about that.
I'll watch it, maybe.
Next year. Yeah. It's a semi-dedication to Justin, because I look at Famicom games I have that I've never played before before doing them for the review. I had about 7 or 8. I got them back in 2005. Back when the Meadowlands Flea Market in New Jersey was worth a damn, and it was still that nice sweet spot right before it jumped off, where you can find, like, I remember probably during that time period, 2005, 2004, you can get like 30 NES games for like $20.
Yeah.
People are giving away. And so I at that point, I probably had 300 games, 400 games. So I was starting to get some doubles, but for that deal, you had to do it.
Sure.
I mean, because you know what I mean? And I still didn't know what games I didn't have. So I would still come home and half the games I already had.
I think just from looking at the graphic, I think one of the games you probably cover, which I find is humorous, is the Goemon game, the first Goemon game on the Famicom, which is funny because I've owned a copy of that, and I think anyone who's ever owned Famicom games that I know has owned a copy of that.
Was it really common? Is that why?
Yeah, I'm sure it must have been. I feel like it's the... It's like the Keith Courage of Famicom games. I swear to God, everyone has one in their collection somewhere.
It's the Phantom Comes Alive of Famicom.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Famicom games. I still got to reskin the website. Lots of good content on thepunkeffect.com, by the way. Lots of good videos and articles there. I booked a trip back to New Jersey. I'm going to go back to Jersey next month. It'll be fun. See my sister. See my friend AJ. If you've never seen AJ, or you've seen AJ. AJ's been in my videos before.
He likes Side Pocket.
AJ loves Side Pocket. So the funny thing about AJ is that whenever you bring Nintendo up, it's almost like a joke that he knows it is. If you bring Nintendo up at all, he'll always go, yeah, you remember that game Side Pocket? Even though he has said it 20 times before. So much so that Ian knows about the inside joke. And I still can't tell if he's just being a dick about it or he actually really loves Side Pocket that much to always bring it up.
I feel like I propel that joke, because anytime I see something Side Pocket, I think of AJ, or I mentioned to you, you know, does AJ need this box copy of Side Pocket?
Yeah, and he even donated for us to play it during the last NES Marathon. Speaking of the NES Marathon, we talked about it, it's probably going to be September.
Probably.
We're looking at late September now. That's kind of where
probably
we're hopefully looking at, like, the 28th or 27th or something. So still a little more time before the wedding, so you're not going to be totally panicking. So, so let's dig into a pretty big topic that, you know, one of the heralded members of the Konami team that worked on the Castlevania series.
So yeah, Koji Igarashi left left Konami, and basically at the same time went and did a GDC talk at the Game Developers Conference talk about, you know, types of games he likes to make, and it's. I don't see it as sad. I see it as a very good thing for the Japanese game industry. We kind of talked about it, you know, prior, where people said, you know, what could the Japanese game industry do to bounce back? And the problem is a lot like the U.S. game industry, all we're seeing are rehashes. And some people misinterpreted what I was saying as being, you know, simple, you know, new ideas. It's not really new ideas. I'm not suggesting that people pull new ideas out of the thin air. You know, they need to go back to developers need to go back to doing what they're comfortable doing. Koji Igarashi got stuck for... Now, Koji Igarashi is the guy who... He didn't create Castlevania, but he very much popularized it in the 90s. The Metroidvania style. The open, like, the exploratory
one,
story.
The one, the style. Ones, like, the ones in the DS.
The ones on the Game Boy Advance, Symphony of the Night. Yeah, the DS ones, exactly. And, you know, he gets stuck for 2 years making mobile games. And he can't do it. And why can't he do it? Because it's just not what he knows. It's not what he wants to do. So he keeps trying and they keep canceling. So finally he says, you know what, I'm done. I'm gonna go, I'm gonna branch out on my own and do what I want.
You think a company like Konami would recognize the talent they have in their employees that worked on one of their biggest franchises, but
might have. I mean, Konami is no better than Capcom or any of the other big guy Square Enix out there who are, the disconnect between what they want and what they think the fans want is just it's massive. So this is another one of those big names like Kaiji Inafune, the guy who created, you know, Mega Man. Another one of those guys who's going to go out, he's going to start his own, you know, his own startup, and he's going to make what he wants, and it's going to make the fans happy. And it's probably, if the Mighty No. 9 Kickstarter was any indication, it's going to make Koji Igarashi money hand over fucking fist. I mean, he's not going to have any problems. And, you know, people were already... people were already coming up with, like, hilarious names, you know, for, you know, Castlemania was one that I really liked, you know.
It's going to be like Castlemania, a guy with the whip that's not, it's going to be like Simon Belton or something instead of Simon Belmont.
But what I think is sort of telling is to hear him talk about his leave, you know, there wasn't a lot of animosity from other people on the same level as him, people who worked with him. Everyone understands. Everyone gets it. I think the corporate structure of Japanese game development is in very real danger, and you know, the whole time they're making these Shadows of the Damned games, you know, everyone keeps saying we want a traditional Castlevania, and Konami won't let them make it. So what happens? Well, their games come out, they get bad reviews, they don't sell very well, and the person who could save them, they've already scared off, they've left. So these companies really have to start thinking about how they're doing business here, because they're going to lose all the creative talent they have.
And plus the veterans that were there that know what makes a successful game or franchise, and maybe they can help. You know, you have a lot of people getting into the industry, and maybe it'd be helpful to have a guy that's been there for three console generations. You know what I mean?
Right.
To sort of mentor. And now those guys are gone.
Yeah,
one major player from Capcom, one major player from Konami. The biggest franchises of each, arguably.
Well, I don't know the exact staff, but, you know, that was always the joke with Final Fantasy, is people are like, well, why is Final Fantasy, you know, not doing great these days? Why is it garbage? You know, why is it different? And it's because, well, Final Fantasy is just a name. Anyone that the current team, you know, people I think tend to think of these things as, you know, books written by authors. You know, the team never changes. The team is constantly changing. Yeah. And anyone who is involved with the Final Fantasies that most people love and remember aren't there. So it's not just that their hands aren't in it, but unfortunately, like you had mentioned, there's no guiding forces. There's no one to learn the ropes from. You know, so basically, like, here's Final Fantasy, here's a bunch of assets you have to shove in there, Moogles, Chocobos, you know, that sort of thing. Make a game, and they don't know what to do with it.
So how do these big companies, do they get startled by this? How should they respond? Should they You know what I mean? Like, how can they, I guess, foster a culture where they want to keep these guys there and productive and creatively fresh, so they're not working on mobile games that they should, guys that have been working in the industry for 20 years should not be working on a mobile game.
Well,
you know?
A lot of Japanese game development is mobile focused, but it's all mostly crap. I mean, you can look at the new Dragon, Breath of Fire that's coming out, that's mobile with in-app purchases. You can look at the new Mana game that's coming out that's going to be mobile with in-app purchases. Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of money over there, but it's not what a lot of people actually want to play. I don't know what can be done. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on Japanese business culture, but we all know that it's slow to change and it's very uptight. So it's going to take, I think, a few more of these guys leaving, and it's probably going to take a big giant toppling like Konami or Capcom
to,
or Square
to
either,
Enix. To maybe not go under, but to actually be humble to the fact that they're really in bad shape.
Right, exactly. And I don't know when that would happen. I feel like we're still a pretty long ways off from that.
You think so?
But it's going to take something like that, I think, for a big change to happen.
Well, Konami's still on my shit list because they bought out the Hudson Soft properties like 4 years ago, and still haven't done anything with them.
Well, they canceled everything that was happening with them.
And didn't do anything after that. Anyway, that's a whole other issue. But
yeah. Anyway. It's a whole other ball of wax. So, anyways, I don't look at it as a shame. I look at it as a good thing. I hope only good stuff comes from it. He even specifically said, unlike a lot of startup guys who leave in startup, he doesn't want to go directly for PC. He wants to make these games for consoles. He wants to give console gamers the games that they want. So, we get enough of these guys making enough money and we start seeing these things on modern systems, I'm expecting we'll see them on portables more than anything. That's cause for celebration.
Well, here's his statement. I've decided to break out on my own to have the freedom to make the kind of games I really want to make, the same kind I think fans of my past games want as well. Leaving Konami was a big decision, and not one I took lightly. I spent my entire career there, made many friends, and had a lot of great opportunities. But I hope all the gamers and fans who have supported me in the past will join me in being excited about what comes next. Wish me luck. He's got a game.
Yeah, the first thing he's going to do is make Castlevania. Or whatever it's called. That's funny. Exactly what he's doing, and that's great. I can't wait.
That's going to be... and obviously I think the copyright rules are a little bit looser in Japan that you can get away with it a little bit easier. That's why my number
hasn't been struck down yet. It'll have a different name and a different main character, but it'll be gothic toned. Just like Mighty No. 9 is robot based with robot masters.
Yeah.
It's going to be Castlevania and it's going to be the same. So that's good.
Well, we wish him luck, Koji Igarashi. Look forward to your Kickstarter next month.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I don't know what would be the next best thing to jump into, but since it's just it's at the top of our list, we might as well cover it. It's been reported that Walmart is going to start buying and selling used games.
Yeah.
This, I think, just to get it out there, especially because there's been some closures in our area.
GameStop closures.
Yeah, there's been some GameStop closures.
One closed near us.
Look, it didn't work for Best Buy, but Walmart has way more money behind it. This could be very bad for GameStop.
Oh, yes.
Why? Because here's what happens when you work in a buy-sell
GameStop,
trade business, okay?
GameStop should be shitting their pants.
Small places like us, Luna Video Games, can give more and charge less because we have less overhead. So our profit margin, even if it looks different on paper, is actually bigger, okay? Mm-hmm. And then something like Walmart... they just have all the money in the freaking world to throw at this stuff. So even if it's a small loss for them, if it's getting new customers into their store for new reasons, then it's going to make them more money in the long run. GameStop is in this horrible, nebulous middle area.
Let's back up and say what exactly they're doing. It's going to be, looks like, newer systems. They're going to be using an intermediary called CE Exchange, which deals with trade-ins of electronic products and like cell phone stuff.
From what I understand, that's just for refurbishing. That's something that...
But it sounds like they probably have a relationship with them already because they already accept used electronics for credit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I think they're probably just going to beef up on that. Yeah, the trade-in plan, this is from New York Times, the trade-in plan is an expansion of a program through which Walmart gives customers credits for used tablets and smartphones that they can apply to new devices. The retailer is betting that it can stimulate sales of new items by giving people a new currency in the form of their old purchase. So this is where GameStop's in deep trouble. Because a Walmart can already charge less for games and most of their merchandise because they have such a huge volume.
Yeah.
So you, like you said, they have no problem taking a loss on trade-ins because people are going to be coming in the store to buy the games new from them in exchange. It's like,
well,
they're taking away a double market because they're taking away games from GameStop that are going to be put on the shelves that are no longer going to be put on the shelves, and plus they're getting those new game sales back that GameStop's not going to be getting.
Well, and the other thing is, and this is the big thing, and this is where it could have, when Best Buy started doing it, it could have been dangerous, but Best Buy is just in too much trouble. Like, well, yeah, no, Best Buy is run like crap and it's in trouble, but this is the big thing. At Walmart, you can take your games in, trade them in for credit, and you don't have to use them on video games. If you want a new TV, trade in all the old games you're playing and put them towards a new TV.
Sure.
At GameStop, you can only trade in for whatever is in that store, so you're feeling limited. So it's one of those things where, you know, people who trade in games and then they go, well, I guess I'll take credit because it's the better deal, and they look around, they, you know, kind of find something they want, they're more likely to possibly go to a place like Walmart where, shit, you could use it on toiletries, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I don't like Walmart, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying that to Joe Average, well, taking your games to a place where you can use the credit for groceries and televisions and clothing as opposed to just more games is,
well, it sort of, I mean, people knock Walmart because they put smaller stores out of business. If you look on the capitalistic side, they also employ a huge amount of people. So it's like, we put mom pops out of business, like GameStop put lots of mom pops out of business, which is, again, why I'm not going to shed a tear if GameStop goes under. So they put most of the mom pop stores out of business, and they have some weird practices themselves. But Walmart's now one-stop shopping. And Target's sort of the same way too, but Target's a smaller degree. But Walmart now, you can go to Walmart, buy your electronics, do all your food shopping. You can go see doctors. A lot of nurse practitioners are going to be in Walmart in the future. You can go get a medical checkup and get your eyes checked up. It's literally going to be like your one stop for everything. And why isn't this not a natural progression? Use game sales. Why not? Game sales are huge. Why wouldn't Walmart do this?
Yeah, I find the Walmart entity terrifying, but I mean, it makes it, within the world of Walmart, it makes perfect sense for them to start taking used games and selling used games.
Yeah. And like I said, it's going to be the scale. So maybe in the future, then we're not only going to get like the, you know, GameStop exclusive level on the new PS3 game. Maybe you'll have the Walmart version.
I think there actually has already been that.
Well, there you go. So why not? It's all fair, GameStop. All's fair in love and war and capitalism, you know. And like you said, people that even maybe have a mom in the Midwest or wherever else, that never even knew this was a concept to trade in used games. She's going to go to Walmart, see big ass signs there. Hey, Johnny, your games from last year, we can trade them in.
Yeah.
Maybe it never occurred to them to go to a GameStop since they're already at Walmart. Like you said, it's a part of their journey. So GameStop, if this really blows up and they get the word out Walmart, GameStop's in deep shit. They're going to be really hurting.
Yes.
So, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean,
there's not much.
They have 3,100 Walmart stores nationwide. The infrastructure's there. This is not going to cost them that much money to get up and running. That's the thing.
They have the space. They have the locations. They have the money. Yeah, could be real bad.
And plus, they talk about how in video games and in used games, particularly, the profit margin's so extremely high, in general, so that it's a no-brainer for them to get into it, like we said before.
Right.
And they're not a Best Buy. Best Buy only specializes, for the most part, in electronics and appliances, so they don't get the foot traffic that a Walmart gets. You go to a Walmart. I don't have a Walmart nearby that's close up, but a Target, it's like a smaller version of a Walmart, has a lot of the same stuff, not exactly. It's always packed.
Sure.
Always packed. So, GameStop, we'll see where you are in like 3-4 years. You know? Sorry. All right.
Working for Luna.
They're just gonna have you guys go to the local Walmart and work there. Now if they got into like retro games, that'd be hysterical. First off, that would be the end. That would be the total apocalypse in terms of prices. Can you imagine that if a big retailer like that got into like NES games or whatever?
I'd have to.
Wasn't it that Toys R Us was thinking about doing that for a while? To some degree, about having trade-ins for old games, and they were taking them in, but then they were giving them up to some nebulous third party to sell.
Yeah, GameStop, I mean, that was always a rumor, too. Basically, there have been rumors circulating for years that these companies are going to get back into it, but Toys R Us, realistically doesn't have the space, and that's what anytime someone walked into the Luna and was like, I hear GameStop's gonna be selling retro games, you guys scared? I go, where are they gonna put them? Have you been in a GameStop recently? They have no space for what they have.
Plus, it's a more specialized product.
Yeah,
there's a lot more. It's not like they
I think
at,
we actually talked about it on
we
a
probably
podcast,
did a little bit
I think
but
they,
it's not like where the NES library is fixed. The Genesis library is fixed. And even that's tough because then you have to manage the prices of all that.
Yeah.
It's not like an inventory at one Luna Video Games versus an inventory all across the U.S. of used retro games that are 20-year-old where the prices you got to be on top of more. That would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. The screw-ups, trying to manage a nationwide system of used game sales, it sounds just horrifying.
Well, that's one of the things that I thought about, too. You know, modern games, the prices are fixed, and the way they drop in price is easy to predict, you know, and you don't have to really worry about rarity or anything else like that. I could see so many GameStops getting hosed on selling something for, like, 20 yeah. bucks. At least initially, 20 bucks, that should have gone for a lot more. Or... on the opposite side, they just overcharge. They just overcharge on everything to cover their asses.
The best example I just had before I think GameStop bought about was in the mall. What was it? Software Etc. Software Etc. And the other, I'm talking like early 2000s when it was still around. It was
Babbage's.
No, it was Computer Store.
Egghead.
No, even a little bit later than that, where it was like Software Etc. was still around in this other store. Which could be still around. That they had some used games with like a sticker on them. But they would be charging whatever, like you said, they'd be charging like $5.99 for Super Mario Duck Hunt. And this is like 12 years ago. They'd right. be charging that much. Or they really don't know what to price the game's at.
Yeah.
They're just slapping almost an arbitrary price on them. And there you go. We're just selling it just to have some sort of inventory. You know. So, GameStop, if this really comes to fruition, this could be your death knell. You already closed a bunch of stores, GameStop. You might be closing a lot more. You'd be joining Radio Shack and closing up a bunch.
You all right, know. We're repeating ourselves. Let's move on.
Hey, they screwed up my Funkoland experience. I don't care what happens to them. So, we can stay on the topic of used games. There was a recent Steam Events auction that closed just today. It was for a loose Steam Events cart only with a case, a repro case.
No, it doesn't add anything.
No, it doesn't. It went for $5,600. That's kind of surprising for a couple reasons. Well, Steam Events has been on the rise the past, I'd say, 3 years, where it was like a $1,000 game. Then it went to $2,000 and $3,000. So I think the last few went for like $3,000 or a little bit below $3,000. This was a charity auction. It said for charity. I'm not sure if that was set up within the auction itself, but I'm more focusing on the final price and the amount of bids going on this. Now, Steam Events don't come up for auction. The NTSC, you know, U.S., North American versions, don't come up for auction too often. Maybe like a couple times a year. Three times. So there's a lot of weird-looking bids going on. There's a lot of bids from people. This one person has a feedback of one. That's always a good sign for a high-priced item bid.
It's from 3,800 to 3,900 to 4,000 to 4,100 to 4,201.
Yeah, and there's also a person with a five. And they're bidding the last, literally, minutes of the auction. So it's a little hard to track how the bids is. Obviously, on eBay, it's automatic bidding based upon a second place sort of thing where the second place person will bid up the first one, mm-hmm. the invisible ceiling of the first place bidder. So, shill bidding. It probably occurs here. It occurs more than people think. What people have to realize about shill bidding is that it doesn't necessarily always mean that the shill bidding won the auction price. The fact that it exists anywhere in between is bad. And this is why. And this is something that's never brought up, even by people in the industry. There's something called... it's called auction psychology. What that means is this. When you get into an auction, and I've been in live auctions at arcade auctions. I've seen it for myself. Besides eBay auctions, I've probably done 2,000 transactions on eBay in the 50. I've been on eBay since 98. So that's like 16 years. Oh my God. When you get into an auction, and this is what some articles, you look it up, and they've done research on this, that there's studies on this, there's a possessive quality to an auction that when you are in the auction and when you are in the lead, you feel like that item, that you own that item. It is yours. So then what happens is when you get outbid, inside, even subconsciously, your pride takes a hit. Your sense of possession takes a hit. You then want to then win that item. Because you already feel it's yours. It's also a feeling that you could be shamed by not winning it. Especially back in the day before eBay started masking somewhat the names of the people a few years back, 3-4 years ago.
You could see,
you could see who it was. So there's a lot of these factors going into an open eBay auction. It's not purely, well, how much is the person willing to spend with it? That's part of it. But when there's shill bidding involved, when you have an artificial person coming in and screwing with people, that's negative because you're inflating the price, and people will argue, well, the person didn't really want to spend that much. They wouldn't have bid it if they didn't want to spend.
No, because it's an outside psychological factor is what it can be, even if that's not what it's intended for. That's what happens. It affects the other people who are seriously bidding psychologically, because I think, to put it more simply, and everything you said is right, but when you look at auction psychology, what it kind of boils down to is it's the competitive nature of humans.
That too.
You are trying to win it. So I don't even see it so much as necessarily... I mean, yes, it is. They have their mind set on it, and it's like watching a game of hockey, or I think a game of basketball is more likely, because you constantly see them score, and then you've got to score, and you keep competing because you both see it as yours, which... It's funny, people think that auctions are going to always be a true indicator of value, but they're not. If you've got two particularly hot-headed people in an auction who really want an item, it's not unlikely to see that item go for more than, say, a buy-it-now value, or for more than what it's actually valued at. I see it happen all the time when I'm looking at games. Like, you can go online, and you can see people buy games, like, day of release, and they end up paying $67, $72 for a game that costs $60. Why? Because they got involved in a bidding war,
sure.
and the psychology of it all took over.
This is from mindhacks.com, and this was written from a guy who wrote about this on the BBC website about auction psychology. Persuasive powers of auctions. I'm going to be reading, and this author's name is his name on the article?
Yeah,
I don't see his name on the article, but this is what he wrote. Another psychological bias that operates in auctions is the endowment effect, where we tend to overvalue things we already possess. I see this with collectors all the time. By encouraging us to connect the bid, our money, with the sale item, bidding on items lets us fantasize about owning them, stimulating a kind of endowment effect. This is why the auction catalog, or the item picture and description on a website, is so important. This forms part of the psychological journey the seller wants you to go on to imagine owning this item in advance. So you'll place a higher value on it, and so may pay more to make imagination reality. So all this is boiled in, but again, like shill bidding adds to that effect. And one final note about a Princeton study that was conducted in regards to shill bidding. This is where it comes into play. Their experiments asked volunteers to play... online auctions with different rules. Some of these auctions had rules that encouraged overbidding, like typical open auctions, which most of us are familiar with, and some had rules that encouraged rational behavior, like the eBay structure. With enough guidance from the auction rules, the bidders didn't end up paying much more than they originally thought was reasonable, but only if they thought they were bidding against a computer program. As soon as the volunteers thought that they were bidding against other live humans, they found it impossible to bid rationally, whatever the auction rules. So again, the competitive nature, the psychological effect, not wanting to be shamed up against losing to someone else, shill bidding plays into that enormously.
Well, right, because it's a squirt of lighter fluid onto a fire. So, I mean, if this is going to happen naturally without shill bidding, you insert a couple of shill bids in there to keep the price, basically to stoke the fires. You're adding another log to it. You're just going to keep this going higher and higher. Now, people are going to drop off, but you're still going to find people who are attached to it who are going to go all the way to the top and end up paying more than they should for the item.
So that's what it comes down to. So... even if a shill bidder doesn't win the auction, it still has a negative effect by overinflating the value. It goes on. It's not documented. It obviously would not be reflected in any sort of price charting website or any app that charts. That's not in there because, again, that's a nebulous sort of data that's in the middle somewhere. Like, okay, maybe it bumped the price up from 50 to 75 and ended up at 80. You know, you're not going to know who that second or third place bidder was. And that's not going to show up. So... to people out there that you know, there's even people that, you know, sort of follow the prices. Just keep that always in mind when these things are valued. That plays an effect. And I'm not saying it can never be avoided between natural humans, as that Princeton study shows. But the fact that the shill bidding helps overinflate the prices, that's why it should be cracked down on more, but unfortunately it's tough to do that. I'm not sure if that means you have to place a rule on eBay that for high priced items you have to have a minimum number of feedback, which would be nice. Or there are some auctions that for high priced items that you do have to be pre-approved.
I was gonna say, I know in the past they did that. If they don't do it now,
that's up to the person selling it. So for those people, you know, that if they're running a true auction, they're being fair, that's great, because shill bidding can exist in, you know, real life to some extent, because if you get stuck with the item, you know, in person, you got to pay for it. It's legally, you know, binding, you know, in person a lot more than on eBay, where you can worm your way out of it. So there you have it. We've all been a victim of shill bidding, whether or not we probably even realize it when it comes to retro games. And just, you know, just kind of talk about it. I don't think the issue gets raised enough. And it's fascinating. I love the psychology of stuff like this.
Sure. And I would like to talk about the hard drive in Proto, just because I played it.
Well, you want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, so actually, it's been out for a while now. I believe it was Frank Cifaldi who got the prototype and released it.
I love Frank Cifaldi.
Yeah,
you know why?
He does all that.
I met him at Port Retro Gaming Expo. We did the Retro Game Roadshow. We kind of had to entertain the crowd for 10 minutes while Chris Kohler was doing something that was a little bit late. And he's a great guy, down to earth. And I love these guys that have these prototypes. Guys like him, Steve Lin, they spend a lot of money on this and then release them.
Yeah.
They don't hold them hostage.
For the good of the people.
They don't
who
hold
want
them hostage
them
like some assholes that'll just hold the game hostage and demand literally like a ransom to have it released
to protect my investment,
you know, even though you don't own that fucking prototype.
Right.
You own the physical copy, you don't own it. So
anyway.
So these guys put these out here.
So yeah, so he got a hold of the hard drive and prototype and put it out on the NES.
Atari arcade game.
It would have been a Tengen cart. And my buddy, Lincoln, actually, he said the documentation that was released with it when trying to put it on a Tengen cart was wrong, so him and some people figured out the right way to get it on there, and he, you know, put it on a Tengen cart and brought it over to my house
night. The documentation was wrong.
Like, what you had to, like, I don't know how to do it, but
the dip switches or whatever?
The pinouts, etc. Okay. What you had to solder to make a prototype reproduction. So, anyways, after two tries, he gets it, and he brings it over, and we start playing it. And Hard Drive-In's one of those games that I always liked in the arcade. Not because it was necessarily good, I was good at it.
It was realistic.
It was neat. Well, no, it was just neat. It was cool.
Wasn't it somewhat realistic, though?
At least somewhat, more
than usual.
Somewhat, but, you know.
I'm thinking of Test Drive,
yeah,
maybe.
Well, they're kind of the same game.
Okay.
So Hard Drive-In, so with the loop and the jump and the early polygonal graphics.
For people out there, if you're not looking up think of a flight simulator, but on the ground.
So, anyways, he brings it over, we pop it in, and the prototype is actually incredibly complete. There's some bugs, for sure, but you can pick between the speed course or the stunt course. You can pick between difficulty levels, manual and auto. And we played it for way longer. The collision detection is funny. If you bump into one car, you know, you get a fracture on your windshield and you're done. But, you know, after grappling with a few rounds of it, him and I got pretty decent at it. And it was really cool to see the Nintendo do things like the loop-de-loop or the jump or the
true 3D,
like
just
the,
about?
The dip. Yeah, and what it was is, according to, I believe, my friend who made the cart, said that
here's
he read...
Oh, here's a loop. My screen is coming up. Go on.
So... what happens is basically Nintendo kind of tricks it. When you enter certain areas, it's not really polygons you're seeing. You're seeing like an animation, but you can still control. So like when we were talking about it, like when you hit the jump, it's very obvious that when you hit the top of the jump, you're seeing a few frames of animation, right? And we thought maybe the same thing with the loop-de-loop, but you can actually drive off the loop. Now, your car doesn't land like it would in the arcade. You just immediately get, like, a fractured screen.
Sure.
Who knows if they would have tried to do more with that. They probably couldn't have. But just a really impressive prototype. And, like I said, it's not immediately accessible, but once you play a couple rounds, you get the hang of it.
It's hard to drive at first?
Yeah, I would just urge people to check it out.
Is there manual and auto shifting?
Yeah,
options?
And I found auto to work the best. And on turns, you just pump between brake and gas. And, you know, it gets you around pretty cool. All the cars always come at you in the left lane in the prototype, so they're fairly easy to avoid.
It's just two races, basically, and that's it? You're not even competing against people? You're just going?
Just like, it's all time attack. It's just like the arcade. You know, you got a course that's built for speed, and you got one that's stunts.
Yeah, I can kind of see how this never came out then, because that seems like a pretty... I mean, even technologically it's cool, but it's not a whole lot to do then. It's just two racetracks, right?
Yeah, but it was
just
interesting to see. So, you know, just kind of a random topic, but I was amazed by how long we played it. Because I think we probably played it for about an hour and 15 minutes. Really? Just seeing who could get the best
time. Is the sound effects cool for the driving?
No, the sound effects are pretty freaking awful, actually.
So you can download this ROM then, and cool. Maybe I'll download it and put it on the power pack for the next marathon.
Yeah, check it out. It's pretty fun. We started to get some pretty good times.
Look it up on YouTube that you can search for it. There's some footage on
it. For all I know, it might actually be on Lost Levels.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It might be. I mean, he released it, so it might be available on Lost Levels.
Good for Frank Cifaldi. My pal, Frank.
But yeah, so that was cool. By the topic way, that's been... Oh, go for it.
I was going to say, by the way, if you want to do Q&A, see you podcast hashtag. I'm going to put that out because we're about halfway through the show.
So something that I've wanted to talk about lately, and I don't know where to start. I don't even know how much of a topic it is, but I'm experiencing some burnout. And I don't even know if it's burnout. The burnout already happened. I'm referring to collecting burnout.
Game collecting burnout.
And it's not with all systems, you know. I think, you know, I kind of want this to be a more open discussion. Hopefully people will comment in the comment section or take it to Twitter. But, you know, have you ever just found yourself at the end of your interest with a system?
No.
Or at the end of owning. Let me say not playing, but owning things for the system. Because that's what's happening to me with Nintendo. I started collecting Nintendo. Bought a ton of it, right?
What year did you start?
98.
So, about the time I started to start buying stuff.
I had, you know, my games from being a kid, but 97, sure. I would say probably 97 was when I started buying games from my friends in high school, and then, you know, 98 was when I started buying a lot. And, you know, young kid, tons of money. Not tons, but, like, I had my own job and I had no rent. That's what I mean. So, all of my income was disposable. Income,
which is where collecting comes from.
All of my income was disposable. I just started buying everything because I wanted this full set. And I created this monster, and I pared it down many years ago, about 3-4 years ago, to about 100 games.
Wait, what was it at its peak?
425.
That's a good collection.
Or 400.
And you got most of that without even eBay, right?
None of it was eBay.
That's commendable.
None of it was eBay. Now I'm thinking. Yeah, none of it was eBay. A couple of them were trades online with people, but none of it was eBay purchased. It was pretty much all flea market finds. So, you know, I pared it all down, and I was like, you know, these are the games I want to hold, but I just find my... Here's the thing. I find my love of going back and playing old games growing a lot more. I find my attachment to the physical object...
Less,
which is strange because it's... And this is why what I'm so confused about. It's not that way with my PC Engine collection. Maybe because I've curated my PC Engine collection. Maybe because I know that anything I walk up to on my PC Engine is something I'm going to want to play. I haven't lost any interest in my records. Records are things that I've been collecting longer than NES games or anything else. I love my records. But is it because I curated my record collection more instead of just going out and buying, you know, whatever stacks I could?
Versus Nintendo, where you just got everything willy-nilly.
Right, and even when I pared it down, it still just didn't look right or perfect to me. And I've gotten to the point, and here's what... It's funny, because I mentioned I bought some new music equipment this week.
Yeah.
My friend Lincoln, who brought over the... Who brought over the hard drive and cartridge... You know, I told him I was thinking about, you know, really getting rid of more of my Nintendo stuff, and if he wanted to look at any of it, he could.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going through, and he's like, "Got some cool stuff in here still." And he goes, "Ooh, Power Blade 2." It's like, "That's about $200." I'm like, "Yeah, well, the label condition's not great." He's like, "You can still get $175 for it." And I was thinking, well, there was one other piece of music gear I wanted. And I was like, what else do I have in there that's worth anything? And he picked out, like, two other games. And I was just like, I immediately found my attachment to them to be non-existent. I'm like...
The monetary value is like, you know what, fuck it.
Well, here's the deal. I could have made up that monetary value with something like my Rondo of Blood, but I wouldn't part with my Rondo of Blood, you know? So it's odd, and I wonder if anyone else has ever found themselves at an end with a system. What am I going to do? You know, I'm probably going to get a Power Pack or an EverDrive if they ever do an NES one, or a Famicom EverDrive, and I'm going to still play and enjoy the games because these are the games I enjoy. I'm still going to work on my PC Engine collection, but I think I've just hit the end of the road with Nintendo, and I can't...
Is it because... Okay, you didn't really explain why, though. Is it because that the monetary value got to the place where you can say, screw it, it's not worth having anymore?
No.
Or is it the fact that you're saying, I'm not playing them, plus the monetary...
I'm not using the cartridges anymore. It could be part of my home
setup. But is that just Nintendo, though? Or what if you're not using a TurboGrafx game?
I use my TurboGrafx at least a couple times a month, if not a couple times a week.
But you don't play Nintendo anymore.
I do, but for whatever reason, because maybe it's because of the location of where I keep my games, maybe it's because of my home setup, I'll fire them up on my computer. I went back to using emulators, which was something I never did. Yeah. You know, and I don't want to keep doing that. Like, I'd like to get a power pack or something, but I don't know what it was. Well, but it's not money. I don't want it to come across as greedy. Like, when he was like, oh, you can get $175 for that, I'm like, well, F it. You know, this is music equipment, but the other stuff that I'm looking to get rid of, you know, I've got a lot of stuff with, like, faded top labels or top labels that are non-existent from getting them from, you know, flea markets. I'll probably bundle them up and sell them as, like, you know, a player's pack of, you know, good stuff. I've got Shadow of the Ninja. Great game. You know, it goes for a little bit.
The label's not the best.
Label's not the best. You know, I'll put them together. It's just, it's not the money. It's the space.
Or even the MAGFest.
Yeah, it's not the money. It's the space. It's the fact that, like I said, it's not money, but
get one of these
what I do get, I could put towards something that I care about more, records or PC Engine. I don't know. It's weird and it's kind of sad because for years I was known as in high school as that guy who collected NES games.
But that happens to everyone. But I'm just going to question, though, when you say burnout, you haven't been actively seeking out NES titles for as long as I've pretty much known you.
Sure. I should...
Besides the Rockin' Cats I got you from Portland a few years ago, I can't think of another new NES game you got.
Which is one I would keep, and I bought Snoopy's Silly Sports Spectacular after our first marathon because liked it, and I'll keep that too because it's Snoopy and it's whatever. But yeah, that's another thing I should put. I've been wrestling with this for 8 years.
8 years?
8 years.
Well, glad it's been that long, because now the prices are highest than they've ever been.
And like I said, I haven't stopped playing NES games. I've just,
Jesus
my Christ. Attachment to the cartridges.
The physical cartridges, you're saying.
Is gone away.
Screw it. But that's almost like, I hate to say it, physical media in general, this could be the last generation that really cares about physical media. A lot.
Well, and I love physical media. I wouldn't get rid of my records. My PC Engine collection's not going anywhere. I think what it's coming down to is people are going to have to look at their physical media, right? I mean, I live in California with my fiance on a basic wage. I only have so much space. We have to start picking and choosing the physical media we want. So, you know, back then you limited your hobbies. Now we can get digital versions of so much of this that it's like, what do I keep that's physical? What do I keep that's digital? When in the end, I still have a controller in my hand, and I'm still playing the game anyway.
I'm probably going to pare down my Super Nintendo collection. Probably my N64 collection. The thing about N64 is I could have probably had a complete library by now. I have the hardest to
just
find
no
game.
Interest.
I have Sculptor's Cut.
Yeah.
After that, it's all downhill relatively easy.
Because even the next most expensive one, like Worms Armageddon, is only like 60.
60.
Did you get that one from us, by the way?
Yes, I think I did. So... Or maybe. Anyway, there's like, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 games that are like $50, $60. After that, it's nothing. Why do I need it, though? And you always say about everything I buy, but this is my love, though. This is a console as a kid. I didn't have N64 as a kid. Super Nintendo, I had like 8 games and played computer more. So why do I have, you know, I probably have 250 Super Nintendo titles, and I have 100, over 125, you know, over like half the library of N64. Why? You know, I have 200 and probably 20 Genesis games. Like, I'm never going to play them. I'm not going to play them.
Yeah.
I know that. So, again, yeah, I can just get the EverDrive for Genesis. I can get the Super Nintendo Power Pack.
And keep what you love.
And 64 one doesn't exist, I don't think, an EverDrive.
It does.
Does it?
Yeah, now it does. Which is pretty remarkable,
actually. And I'm running out of room. I have some cool, nice box Super Nintendo stuff. That takes up a lot. You know, for every Super Nintendo game that's in a box, that's like, you know, 2, you know, loose games. Right there, at least with the depth that it takes. You're right.
I wonder if my job is, you know, part of it too, because
you're always around it.
Because Nintendo is super popular, and I'm always around it. And you work at a game store long enough, you make a career out of it, and you just start looking at the place you work at as like this ever rotating collection.
Yeah, that's
you
what
know?
It is.
I mean, it's what it is. You know,
there's highs and lows for different systems.
So, I don't know. And I really enjoyed my time with the Nintendo. I love all that stuff. Like
don't tear up on
me. No, I'm not. I was trying not to burp.
I think you're getting...
I was trying not to burp.
A little verklempt.
But I've just been around it. I'm going to see it all every day. And maybe that's part of the reason why I don't have Burnout on PC Engine and Turbo. Even though Turbo's hot right now, I don't see it all the time. It's still an exciting frontier for me.
This is what I'll tell you. Because I thought about, if I had to sell off my collection, what am I going to keep? I'm going to keep the games that I'll have almost impossible time getting back. So if you want to go and sell your... Power Blade 2, go ahead. But if you just want the monetary value, sell 30 other games that are worth the same amount and keep the Power Play 2.
It just didn't matter. It went to a guy that you and I both know.
Oh, you already sold it.
Yeah, it went to a guy that you and I both know.
Thanks for letting me know about the Wally Bear you sold, by the way, but whatever.
Whatever. Lincoln saw it first.
I didn't know you were going to sell all your Nintendo games. You never told me.
Well, I didn't. I'm taking my
time. My label could be upgraded, damn it.
I will probably end up with at least 25 that don't go anywhere out of the 105 or so that I have. The Battletoads that my grandma got me for sentimental reasons, even though I hate that game, I'll never get rid of it.
Sure.
You know, my DuckTales, you know, I won't get rid of that. There's ones that I'll keep for, you know, the Rockin' Cats, but the majority of it can just go.
Well, like I said, get a power pack for $160, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you just load the ROMs onto it. I mean, I was lucky when I bought mine used off of, I believe it was Digital Press. I used to buy, trade. People were on Digital Press for them. We're talking like 5 years ago, 6 years. They were awesome because they didn't rake you over the coals. I got my Ninja Gaiden Trilogy in the box for probably only like $50 back then or $60. I don't even know what it's worth now. But I got a power pack. It was used, but it had every game already loaded on it. Most of the Famicom games alphabetized, and I was like, all right, cool. I got it. So, yeah, find a power pack.
Yeah. And
the only one problem with those is that sometimes they're not always available. They have to make more of them. But
yeah.
it is worth it. You've seen it. We've used it. It's great.
So what I'll probably do is, you know, clear off all that shelf space, you know, use it as a place to put, you know, I'll probably just start displaying my PC Engine collection nicer, you know, so that it's not everything is just squished into piles and corners.
Yeah, that I can honestly say. I mean, even if I get to a breaking point and sell off, you know, let's just say I keep the 250 hardest to find NES games, knowing that the other 500 I could easily get back within a few months.
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to sell off the hardest ones because sure. I would even the amount of space would be smaller. But to me, it's like, okay, these, if I ever got back into it, they're there. That's how, but for stuff like the TurboGrafx set, it's so small in comparison. That can all fit in one box.
Yeah.
You know, that's, that can all
but
fit
that's
in
the
box
thing, like, the space that my games are currently taking up now, I could, like, display some of those games outwards, and it'd look
now, nice. My box Nintendo games, that's another issue, because with the exception of that shelf right there of about 9 games, every box game I have is a duplicate of a loose cart.
Right.
So that's different. So if I were getting the mood, like the ones in the garage that are all duplicates of ones loose, I can have no problem selling most of those, except for, the quirky ones that I like. You know, let's just say I have a boxed, you know, I don't know. Give me an example. I think I have Deja Vu in the box. That's a cool one. But a boxed version of Wheel of Fortune, I don't care
right.
about that. I'll sell that and get the whatever, the $6 for it. Or the boxed, you know, box goal I have. You know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have those out there that are going to be gone. So it's not, for me, it's not really burnout, but now it's like my buying has slowed down, believe it or not. You may not believe that, but for... Yeah, don't roll your eyes, but I'm buying less on eBay. Not only because there's less to buy, I have less space, there's less I want.
Yeah.
Because you get to that point, you know, you have a decent amount.
Well, I think we can maybe leave it off on this so we can
move on. It's going to be negative on me.
I'm not going to be negative on you. I think part of it is, you bring up an interesting point. I think part of it for me is...
getting older? Is that part of it too?
I'm getting older. I want less.
You want less.
I don't want as much, and this is something that's going to sound weird, but because I talk about, but I'm bipolar, right? Okay, I think a lot of collecting, like when I was younger, when it was when it was more there, like a lot of collecting, a lot of the early collecting was, you know, manic buying up of this stuff, and as I get older, as these things get more under control, as I take care of myself and things, I just find myself wanting less. The urge to add. Well, even my records, which I love, I add like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 a month. You know, it's not like I'm buying, you know, I used to go to the flea market every weekend and I wouldn't leave until I found 10 or 15 games that I wanted to add to my collection.
Well, we never spoke about this, but how much of collecting is obsessive compulsive?
Well,
and OCD people... obsessive compulsive disorder, people that are prone to that or have that, a lot of those people are collectors.
I can't talk for everyone, but I mean, knowing me and my issues, my OCD, my bipolar, I think a lot of my collecting and why I collected for so many things for so long before I put an end to it was obviously part of the mental.
Those people that have, you know, the people that own, I don't care if I'm stepping on toes, the people that own 10 Donkey Kong Juniors in the box, that's OCD. Sorry, it is.
Yeah.
There's no reason to own 10 box complete copies of a game that's hard to find. Or that have like 30 golfs in the box. Sorry, there's no reason for that.
Sure.
Besides, it's a mental thing.
Yeah,
you know. So I think it is, collecting attracts those type of people in general because it's a need to wanting to keep going with something. With collecting,
That's really what collecting is. You just keep getting stuff and compiling, and there's really no rhyme or reason. When you really boil it down, there's really no rhyme or reason for me to have all these games. I totally understand that.
I think that's almost what happened when
This is past nostalgia. I'll be the first person. If this was nostalgia, I would have stopped on the games that I had as a kid, which were only about 15.
Yeah.
Add up the games I might have rented as a kid, which were maybe 50 games more. I rented, and then add the games I might have played for my friends. We're up to maybe 100, and then you stop. Those are the games I played as a kid. I played 100 different NES games as a kid. I didn't play 750 games as a kid.
And mentally, I think that's another thing. Like, when I go and I look at my NES collection, even the remnants of it as I'm getting rid of it, I'm like, this is just... I didn't need to do this. this is just a memory of a time, like...
Yeah.
What was that? You know, and then I think that's also probably why I'm so positive about my record collection and my PC Engine collection, because everything was bought with a thought in mind.
I look at this more as an accomplishment at this point versus anything else.
Sure, it is.
And not
it's fucking perseverance of some sort.
It's perseverance. This isn't some guy off getting an instant eBay collections within a year. Oh, I got 700 NES games in a year. Buy them on eBay. You want me to be happy for you? This took, you know how many years of walking around flea markets and thrift stores it took to get this? Going to Funko Lands and digging through, and this took a lot. I remember trying to get Bible Adventures for a year just through Funko Land, not even eBay, and going back to the same stores looking for it time and time again until I finally saw that goddamn game on the shelf. It was probably right before I started using eBay. So, yeah, it was probably like 98, early 98.
All right.
You know, so.
Now we sound like cranky old timers.
No, I'm not going to be cranky old. The point is, I earned this, and that's probably why I'll never probably give it up, because I earned it the hard way.
All right, believe me, I understand.
Whippersnappers.
I never used eBay for an NES game. I use it all the time for PC Engine games.
And porn.
All right, moving on. And porn. cartoon porn.
Okay, that's too much information. It was fine just on porn, then you had to go into hentai.
I had to...
Is it hentai or like Fred Flintstone porn images? Yeah, you know,
hentai. I had to grab that ball, intercept it, run it through the end zone... out the gates, across the street.
No, I looked at where it was a fumble on like the 2-yard line.
Latest WWE developments. Let's get this one out of the way.
So we've been saying since the Royal Rumble, that horrific event, how they've been totally mismanaging Daniel Bryan's push in SummerSlam, the most popular wrestler in the company. Probably the most popular wrestler since arguably when The Rock and Stone Cold left in around 2002, 2003. And they've totally been mismanaged his push. They haven't given him a true, as Steve Austin says in his podcast, the green light push, meaning we're putting everything in the company behind you.
Right.
They haven't done that until now. They're finally starting to do that. They can no longer ignore the reaction of the crowds. They've tried to turn him heel earlier in the year. It was like literally a 3-week heel turn, which did not work through either their own planning or the fact that I don't understand why it'd be only a 3-week heel turn back to face, but whatever. And so... at the Royal Rumble, he wasn't even in the match. The crowd turned on it. Batista, who came back after 4 years, who was not a good wrestler then, now he's 45 and just a muscular guy, and that's all he is, and he's not a good worker. He got the main event spot against Randy Orton. The crowd was booing him, though. He didn't come back as a heel, but that's what the crowd made him within a couple weeks, so they decided to turn him heel, which was the right decision, but now you're faced with Orton versus Batista, which you can never do a heel versus heel match.
Your recap is going to be longer than the actual
news. I know, but so the news is this. We always said they had to find a way to insert Daniel Bryan into the main event
right.
to make it right. They are finally backtracking doing that. On Monday Night Raw, what we predicted, which people were saying, oh, Pat predicted it, because anyone could predict this.
Yeah, it's not
originally, the rumor was it was supposed to be CM Punk originally versus Triple H at WrestleMania. Since CM Punk left, Triple H was now going to face Daniel Bryan. And the storyline's logical. He's been getting screwed over since SummerSlam. He got pedigreed after winning the title at SummerSlam, cleanly against John Cena, by the way. And then he got pedigreed, Randy Orton cashed the Money in the Bank, and... Daniel Bryan was champion for like a minute and a half, you know, and then he got screwed a couple more times between then. He could have faced Triple H in between now and then. Now he's going to face him WrestleMania. And the stipulation added, Randy Orton actually had like almost like an Occupy Wall Street
Randy
thing.
Orton?
Excuse me. Daniel Bryan had like an Occupy WWE Raw thing where they had people in shirts come around the ring, like 50 people with him in the ring saying, I'm not going to leave the ring until you give me what I want, which is to match at you at WrestleMania. Triple H acquiesced. Begrudgingly saying you're a B-plus player, I'm an A-plus player, I'm not going to waste my time with you. Then Daniel Bryan added, if I win our match at WrestleMania,
you're going to insert me into the title triple threat match at, excuse me, triple threat at WrestleMania 30, which we predicted it would happen.
Yeah.
So they're going to do that. And then the past Monday on Raw, Triple H said, if I win, I'm going to be in that triple threat match. And Stephanie McMahon's like, what the hell are you thinking? We have a family. You can't be a wrestler again. But then it's the best they could have done to salvage Daniel Bryan not winning the Royal Rumble like he should have, let alone not being in it. They finally realized their mistake, that this is the only option they really have. And Daniel Bryan deserves it.
Yeah, the only thing I have to say is if they do put the strap on him, to legitimize his championship reign, he needs one really stellar one-on-one, well-built-up title defense that he wins.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. He'll have the title for at least, I say, 3 months if he wins.
Right.
Benoit had it for at least a couple months.
It for three. But I'm just saying, like, they need to give him... So if he's going to win it in a triple threat to legitimize it at the next pay-per-view, he needs a really good one-on-one defense.
It'll be against Batista, probably. Because Batista will say, I got screwed out of this. I came back. They've been building up...
Well, I don't know how amazing that'll be, but yeah.
But they've been building up. Sure. Batista's been always saying, I didn't come back for this BS. I came back for a one-on-one shot. I earned it at Royal Rumble. It logically makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
That'll probably be his first opponent after a rematch on Raw with Orton that he'll win. Against Orton. It's a triple threat match, but he'll probably pin Orton.
Gotcha.
And then Batista said, I wasn't even beat. I want my rematch. So there's always a rematch like on Raw.
Yeah.
They'll lose again. But he'll have it for, let's say, 3-4 months. Hopefully until SummerSlam. That'd be nice. A nice 5-6 month reign, which would be nice. And what was interesting is that the build up is now before there was no interesting matches. Yeah, Lesnar, Undertaker, that's going to be interesting, kind of. But the beatdown that Triple H gave Daniel Bryan on Raw was one of the most brutal ones I've probably seen since the Attitude Era. It was brutal because, for a few reasons, there has been a brutal beatdown like that during the PG era to this extent. The PG era started, I think, like 2008.
They used a chair shot, right? I mean,
not just that, to the head.
That's
and those were explicitly banned.
Yeah.
So what happened was he had fake cops come out. Stephanie had fake cops come out and handcuff Daniel Bryan. So Triple H was trying to say, "No, what are you doing? Don't throw him out." And then he revealed that he was in on it and beats him up for it was like that uncomfortable length of like a 10-minute beatdown,
like an old school NWO beatdown.
But no, beyond that, to the point where even like the heel announcers are going, "Okay, that's enough."
Right?
JBL's like the heelish announcer saying, "Okay, that's enough. We've gone too far." Like he was like thrown across the table, handcuffed. He was body slammed, handcuffed onto the announcement table. Like that's even dangerous for his arms, stuff like that. And then holding him for Stephanie, and then Stephanie's McMahon slapping him. It's funny. He's trying to fight back then, Brian. He goes to Stephanie McMahon, "You hit like a girl." It's actually really funny. And then, the biggest thing that was like, holy shit, because even doing this is dangerous to begin with, but doing it in this era hasn't been seen, and it wasn't even on pay-per-view. And like I said, you get fined and banned. You can't even blade anymore.
Did he blade?
He put his head next to the ring post, laying down, and hit him in the head with the chair. Obviously, he didn't really connect with the head, but it looks like it's like the sickest looking shot.
Right.
That if you miss with that in real life, you're going to do damage.
Yeah.
And the fact that they did that during that to show how serious the Triple H was of killing Daniel Bryan, and then pedigreeing him with his arms behind him too, which is, that could be dangerous too, mm-hmm. if you don't want to protect the guy. That's like, all of a sudden now this shit is real. Like this is going to be... That's going to be a brutal match, and Daniel Bryan's going to have to do double duty. Win that match earlier in the card, hopefully not get injured during that brutal, which will probably be a brutal match, then come back and win the triple threat match in the main event for his WrestleMania moment. That's the way it should have been, besides the fact that he should have won the Royal Rumble, but at least it's the next best thing.
All right, it's 10. We're moving on. Let's.
That's your only response? Yeah.
I actually want to discuss some of the stuff I've been watching on the network lately, but we still got Calculords and... Well, I'll talk about it. So, I wanted to... I mentioned it to you. I sent it to you in an email today, but I've been going back and watching stuff. A lot of Savage stuff. And
love Savage.
I fucking love Savage.
He's not a Hall of Fame inductee at this point. It's Jake the Snake.
I thought he was last year. I thought they put him in last year.
Oh, he's not in.
Oh.
He's the biggest guy. He's probably not in it. It's Jake the Snake so far.
Fucking hate Jake the Snake.
Cologne. What's his name? Carlos Cologne. The guy who was down in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
What's his name? The other wrestler, WWE, is his father. Said Lita. Who am I missing?
Actually, there's like five guys. Anyway.
Anyways.
A pallbearer. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was watching...
Ultimate Warrior.
I was watching Warrior. Yeah. Savage. That's it. I was watching Warrior Savage. Yeah. I believe it's WrestleMania 7.
Yes.
It's the career versus career match.
Yes.
And...
Great match.
Well, here's it's deal.
Entertaining.
No, here's the thing. It's this is why I wanted to talk about it, because I feel so torn on it. You can totally see... So everyone who watches wrestling with any... gusto or passion knows that Savage, especially in that era, was really big on spending time with his opponent, and they would always, I mean, rehearse almost everything, more than any normal match, where, like, say, in a normal match, pay-per-view match, there's probably five or six big spots that they want to pull off, but everything else is kind of called on the fly. Well, Savage did his more like choreography. They would plan out the entire thing. Mm-hmm. So the choreography here is fantastic. Savage's planning is amazing. You know, crowd is hyped for this match. My issue is it was such a cartoony superhero match. Like, the planning was well thought out, but... Ultimate Warrior no-sells five diving elbows in a row.
But was that Savage's idea?
Yeah, it was, but I just feel like Warrior had something to say to it, too. You know, I mean, because it was... And I wonder how much of that was politics, because Savage was on his way out of the company at that point.
But Warrior wasn't in a great spot with the company at that point, either, though.
No, I just... It was weird to me to see... I mean, and I feel like it might have been Savage's idea, but to watch him... I mean, it's fun to watch. It is. It's a fun match to watch, because there's all sorts of weird stuff going on and cartoony stuff, you know. You know...
Well, they probably looked at it as...
five? I mean... And then he just, you know...
Well, Warrior was the number two face in the company after Hogan.
Yeah.
You know, and he has the Hulk ability like Hogan. I see what you're saying. Like, two or three would have been enough, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Do two.
And he didn't no-sell all of them. He was out.
Well, I mean, he was out for all five of them. But still, to get up from it, it's like, whoever decided... You just killed all... And this is why ring psychology is so important. You just... ruined that guy's finisher. I mean, granted, it came back as being important later, but, you know, five?
That's your biggest gripe? But come on, post-match, it's one of the greatest moments. Getting back with Elizabeth.
Yeah, I mean, that was cool, and like I said, it was a fun match.
The crowd was yearning for that moment to finally have Savage back with Elizabeth and away from the Sherry.
Sherry, yeah.
I always liked how Sherry looks, because she was sort of like this, you know, the slutty makeup and the, you know, she's barely holding herself together in those dresses.
Well, it was amusing because, you know, Vonnie and myself and I think Anthony and a couple other people were watching it, and the cameras were set up perfectly to get Sherry's ass every single time.
Yeah,
she
was curvy. Yeah.
But Macho Man, one of the best looking outfits he's ever been in there. The Macho King, fucking blue and white with the spangly.
10 different outfits.
Yeah, he had more than that. And Vonnie loves him. She's like, did he make his own outfits? I'm like, I'm pretty sure he had all the input on the design. And she's like, that's amazing. So, anyways, yeah, that's the only one I really wanted to bring up, because it was weird. It's fun to watch. They work it well, especially having Warrior on the other side is not very good. But
yeah, but Warrior can
just weird.
I mean, Warrior Hogan's a good match. You know, like, he can... It is.
Warrior Hogan is a good match, like... Rock Hogan was a good match, though. It's just the electricity.
There were some decent sort of transitions and things in that match, though, that I think Pat Patterson helped them put together that match. But there, it made logical sense. That's what I look for in my matches. I want them to make logical sense, first and foremost. Ring psychology. The fact that there's a reason wrestler does A, then B, then C. There's logical reactions to certain moves repeated, and transitions, reversals, and that match had that, at least. Like I said, Warrior, he has obviously the good ring presence, obviously. The crystal's off the charts. But he could keep up. I guess he can keep up if things were laid out for him.
Right.
What to do.
Yeah.
So, there you have it. What about Sting? You like Sting? I'm so excited real quick just for Sting coming to WWE. I'm going to mark out like it's 1998 again for Sting. And supposedly, the word is he's signed. He just did he was on some sort of show with an audience, and they asked him point blankly a few days ago, and he kind of just coyly, I think the response was the effect of, you kind of figure I am already, but I can't say anything. You know what I mean? That's what wrestlers usually do when they're asked something like that. It's like, well, never say never, wink, you know. Yeah. So he's going to come back. I'm juiced for that because he was supposed to come back. He even said himself he was this close to signing like 3-4 years ago. So it was obviously just a matter of timing at this point. And TNA's been treating him like crap. That's going nowhere, so why not? Why not finish his career in WWE, go in the Hall of Fame, have some good matches against guys like The Undertaker at WrestleMania 31. That'll be a huge match, you know, for both of them. All right.
So cool. Last topic we got for the evening.
Let's talk about a Droid iPhone game from my pal Sean Baby.
Yeah, it's interesting for us to actually kind of discuss and review a game on here, and I'm not sure why we picked this one. Probably because of the Sean Baby connection.
Yeah,
but I love collectible. Yeah, I love collectible card games. Calculords. It's a collectible card game, and it's a lane based combat.
Three lanes.
So there's three lanes, and at the end of each lane is a base, and what you do is you play cards, and those put units in the lanes. And the lanes move every turn, and when they collide with other units, they do battle.
They have hit points, and basically they have hit points and attack points. They have different attributes.
Right. Some have specials, some special abilities.
There's tactics cards, just like any other
right,
card game.
Which is an effect card, you know, buffs and stuff like that. What's interesting about this game is... I'm going to try to keep myself limit myself to rambling. 2 points. This is a free-to-play game.
Free-to-play.
I just want to mention that real quick.
Which is
okay,
nice.
So 2 points. One, the way you play the cards is phenomenally clever and unique. It's called Calculords for a reason. You get numbers, and you get the operators for addition, subtraction, and multiplication. No division. And all of your cards have a number attached to them.
Yes.
And if you get that number by using the number cards that you have, you can play it. Now, if you use up all your number cards, you get a second set of number cards so that you can keep playing cards on into your turn. Once you've played all the cards, you hit fight.
The turn's over,
and any
clashes occur. They advance in the lanes. If they meet the enemy, they fire upon them.
If they meet the base, they do damage to the base.
And then the defensive cards fire back when they're attacked on.
Right.
So this is what's interesting is, yes, you get random. You get 9 random numbers. You get up to 6 cards.
6.
I think you start with 5 until you earn the 6th one when you level up. But, yeah. So what's interesting is that, yes, you have to think. It actually encourages some logical thinking because it's not always easy to get rid of your cards.
No.
And then plus, we talked about this before, you have 6 cards to play. In order to get rid of them in the basically 2 sets of 9 numbers, you really should get rid of at least 3 on the first set of 9 numbers. So to come up with a calculation, and these aren't just like 10 and 13, 44, 52, 83,
yep.
95. I think one card is 115. It's a mutant card you're stuck with. You have to play, or 111. You have to multiply and divide with
there's no division.
Subtract. I mean, well, it's division in a way. But anyway, but the fact of the matter is, you have to come up with logical reasoning behind getting these numbers to where you want them to be. Again, with having no other numbers appear when you use them up on your cards, and so even if you start up slow, at least for me, I'm like, how the hell am I going to do this? You get good at it after you keep playing it. You actually, your mind gets used to it, and after a while, you're finding yourself coming up with problems. It's problem solving.
Right.
It's fun to begin with. Sean Baby designed the game, and he drew all the cards, and obviously his humor's throughout there because of the sayings of the enemies, which is funny. They all personalities, and even how the cards look, and his signature's all over it. But yeah, it's entertaining, and yet you do learn a little bit. Even if you're not really good at math, it'll teach you to get better at it.
Right. So that was the last. Couple points. Yeah, that's what I want to say. I hate math, but the game's a lot of fun because it's math in a unique way. The other thing I wanted to say though is the whole free to play thing is normally a huge turnoff for me because it's never free to play.
Sure.
This game appears now. Pat's played further than I have, but he's beaten it, and Pat didn't spend a red cent.
No.
You don't have to spend anything. What it more is anyone who's ever played an LCG, a living card game from like Fantasy Flight or whatever, what he has made available are a couple of packs where you know exactly what cards you're getting. It's not a booster. It's not like other card games on the phone where you get random shit and they just want to take you for the money. It tells you exactly what cards you're getting your pool.
Yeah, I think it's like 3 or 4 packs of like 5 or 6 cards each, and it tells you what the powers are, what the cost is. But like I said, there's seven enemies. You have to beat each enemy two or three times to advance to the last one, who's called Hate Bit, which is funny because Hate Bit speaks in like English, and he's just like an 8-bit face. And it's funny because every turn they'll taunt you, or if you're spending too much time, they'll taunt you with things. But it's not easy. It's not an easy game. You have to think logically. There's one enemy who's the third to last enemy, I believe, that will always use a tactics card to shut down one lane so you can't deploy units that lane, which means you can't really defend it unless you get a tactics card or some special card. So that means it's like a race against time, or you have to be very smart. So the enemies do act a little differently, which is nice.
I believe all the in-app purchases in total add up to about $10.
Even if you wanted to do that.
Even if you wanted to, which if you enjoy it, is more than, which I think is more than fair enough, and I think it's a really well-made game. My thing is, I may buy a pack, or I may, you know,
you may
just to check them out. Well, no, because they're different cards. I may trust two, but my thing is here's the big problem. The game has no multiplayer.
Yes.
If the game had multiplayer, I would buy all the card packs in an instant just to give myself more.
We'd be playing during the day.
Just for more deck building, just for more deck building options.
But you can build a deck by, when you defeat your enemies, you get one or two cards. If you go back and defeat the same enemy, you'll get one or two cards. It could be the same ones, it could be different ones. So I've beaten every enemy probably, besides Hate Bit, which is the last one, who's extremely difficult. I've only beaten twice, and probably lost about 12 times. So it's difficult. But I've gotten some. I have a good deck. I have like 120 something cards. I think I use a deck of about 103 because there's some cards I don't like.
Well, that's insane.
What, that many cards? I don't know much about this world.
Yeah, really.
I should pare it down more.
If it says the minimum is 30, you always go for the minimum.
Does that mean you can reuse the cards? Do they come back into the deck after they're gone?
You just use the best cards you have. I don't know how they do it in this, but Magic is 60 cards. I can't say no one, but for the most part, everyone is going to play with 60 because
there's not more than 10 moves.
Because what you do is you, as you get more cards, you put the best ones in. You don't want to have to keep pulling your crap cards to get to the good ones. You want your deck tight and focused, and that's any card game.
So you can't run out then. What if you run out of cards and
well,
you lose?
Well, no, you can. I mean, for instance,
I've done more than ten turns is playing this game.
For instance, in Netrunner, if you're playing Corporation Side and you lose all your cards, you die. That's a tactic that another. Yeah. But there's far more negative to having more cards than you need than less.
Okay, try to beat the last couple guys with 30 cards and see what happens.
If you build your deck right, you probably should be able to.
You're not. I'm just telling you, you're not. You're gonna be struggling out every tooth and nail, especially since there's cards like. That there's a card that you can be used against you multiple times against, I think, the captain, what's his name, Corp, or the General Brack, whatever his name is. He uses the offensive shout, which gets rid of all your offensive unit cards. So you'll be stuck with one card for some turns, or zero. All of a sudden, those five are gone, or six are gone.
Yeah, but
and he does that multiple times.
That's going to happen no matter how many units you have.
Yes, but what happens then when you run out of cards? If you only have 30 cards.
He only has a certain... I don't know. Look, I've played card games plenty. Okay. You always want always want the smallest, most precise deck you can build.
The computer hasn't run out of cards yet in any game I played. And like I said, I played a game yesterday against Hate Bit, the last guy, and I probably sent at least 50 units his way.
No, we'll see.
It was a lot. It was a lot.
We'll see if I get further.
Well, you'll see. But it's a fun game. I haven't bought it. My deck is nice. But yes, Sean Baby, if you're listening, hell, maybe we'll interview him about it. Because I met him at Portland Retro Gaming Expo. He was like 30 feet away from me the whole time promoting the game. I think at the time he was actually thinking about having a price on it, or maybe not. But he was a nice guy, and he explained the game to me. And honestly, I'm the type of person that unless I play it, I have no idea what's going on. He explained it to me, I don't understand it. I honestly was like, okay, that sounds cool, I don't understand it.
Yeah,
I played it, the tutorial, it's fine.
Yeah, and I think we can...
And you can also even edit the numbers that appear for you to do that, that gets into a whole level of strategy
that my non-math brain, you know, just doesn't have. But yeah, we can leave it with that. I think really
it's worth checking out.
You've heard us talk about it. Really the best thing you can do is it's free. Download it. It's not going to beg you for cash. Just play a couple rounds. You'll enjoy it. You'll understand it way better than we can describe it.
Decent music, funny, like kind of that in between 8 and 16 bit sort of sprites style, which is nice. Like 16 bit wannabe 8 bit sprites. So yeah, maybe we'll get Sean Baby on for an interview. In the future about it. It'd be nice. So, Q&A time?
Yeah, let's do it.
This has been a nice, tight podcast with lots of topics.
I'm going to... use the restroom, so why don't you hum a little intermission tune while you
Ian's pissing, questions. This is the tune, or ain't Ian takes a whiz, what does it mean? I don't know, Ian's got the bladder of a four-year-old. Oh, real quick, maybe we can talk about, over the weekend, the stream we did for Justin on Retroware. That was fun.
It was.
We did it Saturday night.
We tried to stick with imports because that's what he always loved. And
it was American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Yep.
I think we raised about $400 in a couple hours, dude, which was nice.
That is cool. It's not just the money you raise, but by donating money to something like that, you're kind of saying, I don't believe there's a stigma to this anymore. And
sure.
The more people who come out and say that, the better. It's really freaking important. But we did have fun. We played imports. I grabbed a couple of Sentai games because I think he probably would have been into those.
We had fun. We had a great time playing the Cyber Combat Police.
Yeah, fighting Fire Frog.
I want to put that online because I think that's hysterical, some of those things. I want to put like a best of clips of those. It was fun. I came back and played Magical Chase in like a half.
Yeah, I heard you played Valus for about an hour or two.
Valus 2, which I forgot I had, and I got to like the... I think it must have been the last level. It was impossible, the last level.
Those are great games. Her attacks
are so underpowered. Once you get that far, it's like you got to hit the same guy 14 times to beat him. It's like, come on. But it was fun. I enjoyed playing it. And even though you see like a, you know, Japanese hentai ass, basically.
All right, so I'm going to... We'll start with this one.
You want it?
Yeah, why not? We can both go through.
Well, let's go all the way down.
Ooh, I did.
You want to be the guy that runs through them for a change? Or are we going back to? What's the date? What's the earliest date? March 7th.
Ago. Yeah, I guess you start.
How did you meet Frank? That's a mystery.
Yeah.
What does Ian think of him? And does Frank enjoy being in your videos? What do you think of Frank?
Frank and I gel on certain topics.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but is that all you're going to say?
I like Frank a lot. I like sitting in Frank's backyard, watching birds.
Looking at Frank's backyard.
Smelling meat cook.
You haven't been over in a while.
Sharing knots. Anyways. So,
Frank enjoy being in my videos?
No.
Not until he's doing it.
He doesn't.
No, he does.
I don't either.
Well, you two are not a good influence on each other around me. The one shoot we did together with all three of us, you were both bitching within literally 10 minutes. You did not make it easier. You made it tougher. I'm talking about the cliffhanger part two. But no, Frank has enjoyed being in videos. He enjoys being in the videos that don't take a huge amount of time, take like an hour and a half to do. And he actually enjoys seeing the result. And he likes doing the Ask Frank videos and things like that. So, I mean, he's always regretful until actually he's into it. He's like a diva. Once he's actually doing it, he's like, okay, it's fine. For the most part. This is an easy question. I'll just say, this is from Shane Prutzman. What is the worst example of an NES game not worth its inflated value due to poor playability?
Stadium Events.
I was going to say 1, 2, 3 Stadium Events.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of really rare games, you know, aren't generally worth the money you pay for them in terms of fun, but Stadium Events is the king of that.
Yeah. And it's even more apparent because you can buy world-class track meet. So it's really then worth the $3 that you can buy world-class track meet for. This is from Jaron, who also writes for thepunkeffect.com. Check him out. With gaming journalism reporting, in quotes, leaked content, do you think these leaks are intentional marketing?
Yeah, it's possible. I have a tough time really looking at any game journalism site as anything other than intentional marketing. I mean, it leaks. I don't see them as being negative to the company, and it makes the website maybe sound interesting. Oh, we got this leak or we got this scoop, but I don't know, because you look at it and places don't break embargo, you know, NDAs, you know, the really big things, they don't. So these...
Well, they need their free copies to review.
Yeah, so these leaks, I feel like they could totally just be a clever way of spinning a headline.
Which is why, to me, journalism doesn't begin in the first place. If you're on the fence, I mean, if you're always, you know, you're leashed to these sort of rules or else you won't get your free copies and you're screwed.
Right.
And that'll prevent you from maybe putting on an overly negative review, then you're not a journalist at that point. You're just a barker. Yeah, I called Jeff Keighley a barker before. That's what I think he is.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a journalist.
This is from at David Snusgrop. Why doesn't Ian like Braid? Not a huge fan myself, but I found it cute and entertaining, albeit quite pretentious.
It's kind of pretentious. That's honestly not really what bothers me as much as I just hate that time rewind puzzle puzzle platform mechanic. I really just could not dig it. On top of the fact that I didn't really care for the way it looked, I didn't care much for the story. I understand why a lot of people would probably enjoy it, but I couldn't hang with it for more than half an hour.
And by the way, guys, just so you know that the more questions we got every week, we can't answer all of them. If we answer ones before, if I'm looking on the fly, I don't think they're interesting. I hate to say it, or you know what I mean. I'm trying to keep it fresh. Plus, like yes or no answers, I try not to.
You could shower. That would keep you fresh.
I do shower every day, Ian.
That's good. I like this question, so I'm going to ask it. We know about devils. This is from Rickety Rack.
Where are you at? You're not going in order.
Whatever. We know about Devil's Crush, Kirby's Pinball Land, and Pinball Quest. Are there any other hidden gem pinball games we should play? Yeah, absolutely. You can't discount what came before some of these games. Alien Crush is really, really good. It's only 2-level instead of 3-level, but the mini games and the quality of the design is still there. Same with Kirby's Pinball Land. Gator's Revenge is Revenge of the Gator is arguably the precursor to Kirby's Pinball Land, made by HAL.
I had that.
Yep.
I think
it's a ton of fun. It's only one table, but it's really good. I really like Rockin' Ball on the NES for the 2-player pinball modes.
That.
We have fun with that every year during
Rockin'
the marathon.
Because there's a few different ones.
And then Pinball FX and Pinball Arcade are both really good modern pinball games. Pinball Arcade aims to recreate, you know, real tables, and Pinball FX is a little bit more freeform. But yeah, there's tons of good pinball games out there.
Yeah, we'll just alternate, but I'll try to keep in order.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on Power Blade on the NES? This is from Mr. Drunk Reviews, and is the expensive sequel worthy? Well, Ian, your thoughts on Power Blade?
I really like both those games. The second one didn't stick with me as much as the first one
did.
It's
one of those drop-offs.
But, you know, my buddy who pointed out the worth of it to me said he likes it better than the first one. So it depends. But yeah, I look at it like a Chippendale 2. Or DuckTales 2.
It's
still a good game, but it's not as good as the original.
Yeah, you're not missing out that much if you don't have it. Especially
right.
For the 100 and whatever. Eight, I
think. Well, because the first one's perfectly good and you can get that for cheap.
God, I got my copy for like $35.
I bought mine for $5.
Well, I'm talking about.
I know. I'm just saying it's another reason why. Yeah, I'm talking like 98, which is another reason why I wasn't sad to see it go.
All right, you pick one.
Let's see.
Quickly.
Did you? Okay, this is from Nathan Wilcox. Nate Wilcox, 23.
I don't even know where you're looking, by the way, since I don't even see that question.
Did you ever experience anxiety about appearing or watching yourself on video? Yeah, I still can't watch myself on video, and it's one of the main reasons I hate being in Pat's videos, and I don't watch them.
Even though you do a good job.
Thanks, I appreciate
it. The anticipation video was still a blast.
I did watch that once with you, I think, because you made me what you were like, you've got to watch it, and it was amusing.
It was like 2.5 years ago we shot that almost.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, the reason why that one worked and that one was fun is because it wasn't that much different than this. We had, you know, our scripted intro and outro segments, but the playing of Anticipation was just you and I sitting around shooting the shit.
That's why we needed a Let's Play with Ian and Pat. Okay. This is from at Callum Hawks. If you could have any franchise made into Lego, what would it be?
Lego the Ring. I want Lego Ring. You can't make
the
game.
Movie The Ring.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Knight Rider. I don't know. your turn. You should just go from top to bottom. I'll go bottom up, I guess.
All right. Let me see what these are.
My turn. You're taking too long. This is from at Rapture in Venice. How many times, Pat, did you intentionally screw up takes with the dominatrix so you could, in quote, film them again? I actually couldn't because she was on the clock and I was paying her. So, I mean, we agreed beforehand how long she was going to be staying. So she actually was really cool, Julia. And we went over by probably 45 minutes. But she had to get out of there. She had to go to the dungeon to work.
Right.
You know, that's, I think, no longer downtown. I think they closed it, unfortunately. But, we really didn't. I didn't want to do the spanking shot 5 times. My ass was hurting for 3 days, but I wanted. I for my art, I sacrifice.
So this one's from Zach Tyke at Pens_Mini66. What do you guys think about the Peanuts movie coming in 2015? Okay, This is a touchy one for me. I'm a huge Peanuts fan, sort of a Peanuts collector, although I've really slowed down on the stuff that I get that's not books or specials related, but very near and dear to my heart, probably one of my favorite things ever, the comic strip. Storyline-wise, I feel like they could get the spirit of the Peanuts right. I've seen that with the comics that Kaboom has put out. The 3D, guys. Holy shit. Why does it need to be in 3D?
It's easier to do.
Yeah, I'm going to sound like that guy. I have no interest in watching it. I have none.
Really?
No interest in seeing it. I mean, like I said, I feel like they could get a decent story. Because whoever's been in charge of his estate has been doing that well.
Why would Mrs. Schultz agree to it then?
Well, it's been said that she worried about it a lot, but that's just hard for me. I haven't watched a lot of this.
This is Bill Watterson's greatest fear, by the way. This is why he'll never do a movie.
Yeah, exactly, and I understand.
Or even anything animated at all.
So the story could be passable. It could be in the spirit of Schultz. I just don't think doing a 3D CG Peanuts movie is in the spirit of Peanuts at all.
You think that goes too far away from
right? I'm not saying it can't be done or can't even be done reasonably well. I just,
for you, it's not there.
It's gotcha. Yeah, I right.
This is from Mark Varley, who writes a really cool indie gaming column on the Punk Effect and does reviews. Two tweet question: do you think next gen consoles will become a revolution or remain an evolution? New games are very familiar, but only have better graphics. I think we said it before that this next gen is not a revolution. It's like a 1.5 version of the consoles that came before. PS4 is like PS3.5. That's, you know what I mean. There's not enough different from the last system. It's almost not necessary. They could have waited 2 years maybe. It'd be like, oh, but the graphics. If that's all you're really upgrading, you're not even upgrading to. It's not the step from PS2 to PS3. PS3 to PS4 is not that step. It's somewhere a lot less significant.
It's,
so we talked about this before. I think this is the last real console generation. I said that before.
The only thing I can say, like, to add to it is, you know, when they announced it, the PS4 and the Xbox One last year, I was like, well, I don't want an Xbox One, I don't think. And the PS4 looks like there's potential, right? I'm like, but we'll see. I'm not really excited. I said, I bet when we get into 2014 and some announcements start hitting, yeah, I'll be more excited. I haven't been less excited about any consoles in longer than I can remember.
Let's just grab the refurbished Wii U for $200. Let's just do that.
Yeah, no, I mean, a Wii U sounds fun, but I mean, I'm having fun playing through my back catalog. There's still great games for the PS3. I just got, Dark Souls 2, and with the amount of time that I have to play games, that and Gundam Breaker will keep me busy for months.
All right, your turn for a question. Not ready to go, Ian.
Just keep going.
You're shirking your responsibility.
Oh, I do want to talk about this one. Cartridge Brothers. At Cartridge Brothers. Which wrestling tag team is your all-time favorite? I'd pick Demolition or The Rockers. I actually really like The Rockers. And the more I watch some of the older stuff, the more I remember why I really like the Rockers. They're fun, they're entertaining.
So many two-man moves, you know?
A lot of good stuff there. Most of my favorite tag teams, though, were Japanese tag teams, and they were kind of one-offs. They would usually come out of factions, like the ones that you'd see in Dragon Gate. But, like, the three-man tags and some of the two-man tags over there, like, Shima and Yoshino.
Not with Dragon Gate at all.
It's what Toriumon was. It's Ultimo it was Ultimo Dragon's gym.
Okay.
And then Dragon Gate split off of it.
Okay.
Okay. So, like, Shima and Yoshino and all those guys did, like, great tag matches. It's different in Japan. The tag teams don't seem to be as uniform, but the tag team matches are a lot more fun. Here, the tag teams tend to stay together forever. But I don't like...
Not so much anymore. I mean, they started breaking up after like a year and a half here now.
Yeah, but. So I can't think of any real modern ones. I know there's ones I'm missing from like the WCW era, but the Rockers would be a classic.
I just love the Killer Bees. Oh. This is what I grew up with.
I like the Fabulous Freebirds as well.
Fabulous Freebirds.
Because I love Michael Hayes.
What tag teams are they even like in WCW? WCW did not have, during the heyday of the Monday Night Wars, they didn't have a lot of good tag teams. They're always hodgepodge thrown together, like DDP with like Canyon. You know,
it was like the Barbarian and Ming.
If that, you know, I see what you're saying. I like Demolition. I did. Just from their outfits, I did. I
never got into them.
Smash. Ah!
You know, yeah.
I want to do two questions because the first one's a comedy one.
Sure.
Hate to give it away.
Have you ever thought of changing the name of the show to Two Guys, One CU Podcast?
Oh, yeah, I saw
That's
that.
That's very clever. Very clever, John. At that Craig fellow, question for both Pat and Ian, what is the most memorable open world slash landscape from a game for you and why? Privateer 2, just because I'm in love with the space exploration side of like an open world. It's a shame that they didn't follow it up with Privateer 3, because Privateer 2 was fair. It was a lot to go through, but it was fairly limited what you can do. There is yet to be that really huge open world game that you can, that with the technology now for a space exploration like Privateer 2. I think there was Freelancer as one, but I'm talking about like modern sort of, like, really can do it up. Like, yeah, like a GTA in space. That is
right,
what
they
I'm
don't really
for.
Do those types of games anymore. So that's the thing. Those games could... Oh, so I should answer the question too. And this is not because of your answer, but one of my earliest memories of one and my favorite is a game called Lightspeed by Microprose, which was also a diplomacy slash dogfighting slash mining in an open space environment, like an Elite type game, you know? And
so
I loved it.
That's even more in Project. You could even do mining.
Right. You know? So what I love about... What's interesting about those games is it was very easy to create a very big world on an old computer because space has no landmarks or anything like that. I would love to see a modern day version of something like that with the power that we have, you know, the randomization. I mean, how much can change every time?
You can replay it, put in a main storyline, but then have a bunch of hundreds of side missions and quests.
Yeah, the thing is, you don't have to change much. Just a person in their ship, make some good dogfighting controls, and really work the diplomacy angle.
What is it? Is that your diplomacy? Diplomacy?
Dollars for diplomacy.
Diplomacy, that's diplomacy. A new word. And hell, you can even have it so modders can make their own missions and quests, or, you know, make their own missions, and that would be cool.
Yeah, there's definitely a market for this.
Yeah, God, Privateer 3 was in development and they canceled it, and I was like, oh man. Because as cool as seeing Clive Owen and John Hurt and Christopher Walken in Privateer 2 was, the main story isn't what really drew me to the game.
No.
It was the side missions and the freedom you had, even though there were problems with that game. I never played Privateer 1 before Privateer 2. That was my first sort of, you know, jump into that universe. All right, your turn.
I told you to take it from me.
Okay. At Video Game Heaven, being a sponsor, my story is going to be in a future issue of Read Retro, I guess as an advertiser. Do you enjoy writing for them as a regular? I've only written for one issue of Retro, which is a retro magazine being put out by Mike Kennedy from Game Gavel. I'm in issue 2, which is coming out within a month. And then I'm going to be in issue 3, which I still have to write. I guess I'm going to be a regular writer. I like writing. The fact that I'm technically now a professional writer. I showed you the check today. I'm like, I'm a paid writer. That's really cool. So yeah, it's a cool thing. My article series is called NES Nation. I figure that's appropriate. And kind of humorous and kind of informative at the same time, like my videos. So yeah, look out for the first issue. The second issue of my first article is going to be about hypocrisy and NES censorship. This is from at Cygnus Destroyer, Matt, who's in the chat, helping out. Are either of you Doctor Who fans? If so, who's your favorite Doctor?
I am. I'm a recent Doctor Who fan, and my only real experience so far is with Tennant, and I really like him. I want to go back and see the Eccleston stuff, because I really like Eccleston as an actor. He was only in, I think, 9 episodes, 1 season. So I'd like to go and see that.
Or 13, something like that. It was like one. Yeah, it was one.
It was one season. My fiance watched that stuff when I was out of town, I think at MAGFest, and she said that Eccleston was great, but, you know, he was basically used simply to reintroduce people to the universe, and Tennant, you know, became the face for a long time. That said, I'm really enjoying it. I'm loving the show. It's funny. It's, you know, people I think are intimidated by Doctor Who because there's so much lore and backstory to it. But it's one of those shows that actually you'd be surprised. You can just kind of drop in and watch it, and you can figure it out because it everything's changing. Everything is fluid. Everything is once you get the basic concept of what Doctor Who is about, you can start anywhere.
I watched the Christmas special, and then the one before that. So I watched the 50th anniversary. So as someone who never watched the full episode, I always saw parts of it. I saw the 50th anniversary, which is cool. I'm a big fan of people that like connecting the past and things like that, and any sort of continuity of comic books. I love when they have a history.
Yeah.
And 50 years, that's awesome. And so having the finale, even though I was not familiar, it's like, wow, it gave me goosebumps seeing all the old Doctors help out and how they did in the 50th anniversary. Then the Christmas special, which was the last episode for Matt Smith. And I actually teared up.
even though, as someone who not followed the series.
This is the beautiful thing about
it. Was so well done and such a good send off for this actor and character, and so heartfelt. It's like, wow, this is getting me emotional, and I'm not even that emotionally invested in this.
That's the beauty of Doctor Who, is even without a whole lot of investment, this each story, whether it be a one shot or a multi parter, they're written so well that there's a lot of humor. But I can't tell you how many times I've choked up watching episodes of Doctor Who.
Sure. It's lighthearted, but it's dramatic as well.
They're very, very good with the drama and the human emotion.
Okay. I'm not sure what that one is.
Describe a day in the life of Patter Ian from sunup to sundown. This is from Narc Podcast. This is real easy. Here's what I do. I wake up, I shower, I throw on whatever clothes don't smell like shit. I go to work, I deal with people all day.
That smell like shit.
I come home, I drink, I go to bed.
Do a podcast sometimes.
Do a podcast sometimes. Do some writing. Read.
Deal with Pat's inane phone calls throughout the day.
Snuggle with the fiance, play a couple games, go to bed. 9 hours of my day are dealing with sometimes really, really nice people, and other times just jerks.
I wish I had a typical day. I mean, I get up, I do some writing, I work on some of my video stuff, my website. I go to the gym almost every day. Some people know that. I try to stay in decent shape. I'll hang out with Frank a couple times a week. Probably on average, I'll see Frank 2 or 3 times a week. You know, we'll hang out. Hang out with Ian once a week, maybe.
We hang out on Wednesdays, and I always have people over to my place on Sundays for games and video games.
I gotta get to that, but you gotta come to Frank's.
With Frank.
You haven't been to Frank's in 2 years.
You haven't been to my house.
I was at your Frank's like a few weeks ago I came over.
You came over on Saturday.
All right. So that's our typical day. It's not too typical.
It's our typical week.
The one thing that's surprising, that besides this writing project I'm working on that requires me to play games, which we'll reveal later in the year, I don't play that many games every day. Besides the ones on my phone, I play Zynga Poker. I want to play real poker because I think I'm decent at it, but whatever. That's fine. That's our typical days. They're not really typical.
Interesting.
At Chiba UFO, Christina. Hey, Christina.
Hello.
Have any of you tried the Retron 5? What are your thoughts and opinions on it?
You can watch it.
Go on YouTube. You type in Retron 5, Christina. I'm the first video. I did it for Retroware at E3 last year. What a great time I had at E3 last year. It's a whole other topic. At least post E3, finding out what happened from there.
Shut up and focus.
So Retron 5 does it's going to be, I think if it does what it's promised going to do, I'm going to get one. I think it's going to be very successful. It's going to be a blend of hardware and emulation, things running like save states, filters. I think it's going to be great. I personally do. If it promises and if it's built well.
Yeah, that's my concern. I haven't touched it yet, but I have touched a lot of Hypercon products, and you know what? I have cause for concern, but so many people want this. I think all the delays have been bullshit reasoning. I think they're delaying it because I'm hoping that they're actually like, wait, whoa, if we ship this out and like it has a failure rate of X product, then we're boned.
Well, they already said the first delay was because of the pins or whatever.
Yeah. Anyways, I'm cautiously optimistic.
This is from at Mega5K. Megan, hey Megan, it's rumored there will be another Capcom character added to Smash Brothers. Which character do you think it will be?
I think Ryu would be a pretty easy choice.
I don't like seeing human type people in Smash Brothers like Solid Snake. That's kind of doesn't belong. I like the cartoony characters like Mega Man or Sonic. That's
But I just feel like, I mean, to me, if you're going to pick one obvious fighting game choice, it would be Ryu, you know? It would make sense.
This is from at Game Mana. What do you think of Shaq Fu 2? I guess this is a new Kickstarter. I've heard a little bit about it. I don't know.
Now you're getting into my territory, so I think we're kind of
wrapping up. Now we're going to wrap up. I'm not doing a top 10 list. Sorry, Juan. I'm not doing a top 10 list on the podcast. This is from at NickSteve7. Talk about the Godzilla movie. It's coming out in May, I believe, right?
I'm getting more excited about it. I've heard a couple of things.
Bryan Cranston's a great actor. He's in it. And they're taking it seriously, which is nice. Not like Godzilla 2000.
Trailers have done nothing for me.
Really? But the first one I thought was cool.
But the trailers haven't excited me, but what they've done is show me a tone that I can get behind. So I'm okay with that.
This is from at Blaster Master. Oh, hey, Blaster Master. If you've seen the new trailer, what do you guys think about the new, albeit late, Sin City sequel? Yeah, this has been developed for 4 or 5 years. Remember, Sin City came out in 2005. This is 9 years later.
It's based upon A Dame to Kill For, which I have and read, and it's an excellent story. It's a prequel story, which came out after the original Sin City graphic novel. It has Marv in it. Marv's in it, and he teams up with the Clive Owen character. What's his name? I totally forget his name right now. But he's going to look differently, so I think he's being played by Josh Brolin, because in the story, spoilers, he gets plastic surgery partway through to look like how he does in Sin City. I think it's going to be fine. I think the original Sin City movie was done well. It sticked with the comic about 95%. There's only a couple things they omitted out, but otherwise, I thought it was fine. If you like that sort of thing, it was done well enough. Carla Gugino, thank you for being naked. You have an awesome body. That's all I'm going to say about Sin City 2. People, that's whenever I bring up the movie, that's what Frank says, and I agree. Amazing. So we'll see. I'll probably catch it, if not in theater, on DVD.
All right, take us up one more.
A couple more. We're running out here. Okay.
Like I said, I've covered.
Well, you didn't get at Zack Attack 1984. Do you think collectors who obsess over condition owning every game are partly to blame for recent flood of fake games? If they would stop paying so much attention, they could just have their complete sealed VGA 85 plus collection, then there wouldn't be as many scammers. No. I think the scammers aren't to blame for having fake games out there.
Collectors aren't to blame because the thing is the
how do you blame the people that want it versus the scammers?
So if you're looking at like fake NES games, that would be the scammer, not the collector. And what tends to determine what games get counterfeited the most when you look at modern things, it's Pokemon. It's stuff that's wildly popular that can be, you know, that they can easily deceive people with. It has nothing to do with collecting. I'm usually not a huge fan of collecting to collect and mass consumption. We've discussed my issues with that, but no, it's not the collector's fault. That's ridiculous. That's blaming the victim.
Yeah, that's dumb. I don't like stuff like that. This is at WB Stillwell. Do you guys think virtual reality will succeed or will it fall by the wayside like motion controls?
Ooh, I did want to talk about that one. I don't think virtual reality is a gimmick. I think it's a matter of when it gets to the level that it's considered decent enough. I mean, you look at motion controls, right? And, you know, something like the Kinect. This is all kind of like in 3D on a 3DS. This is all kind of VR for tots, you know, like it's a way of getting you to interact or see things differently on a game than you normally would, because what people really want, or what they want to eventually sell you, is a truly immersive experience.
Sure.
And that will come eventually, and when that does, I think that's going to be just like television, you know, it's just going to be a new form of entertainment. Now, will there still be a spot for games on a screen? Absolutely, and I think I'd probably stay there, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be a gimmick. I think that will, when virtual reality actually hits as a marketable thing, I think it's going to be here to stay.
I'm on the fence. Obviously, 20 years ago, 93, 94, 95, when you'd see it in the malls, you see those virtual reality stores, the technology wasn't there yet,
right,
visually. Now that you have like the Oculus Rift and you have other stuff trying to have the control, and they seem to be working. I don't know. I'm on the fence. Part of me thinks that, yeah, it's going to be cool. Part of me thinks that gamers want to get a controller and quickly play and not strap on fucking gear, you know, like, to play.
Well, that's kind of my thing, too.
And then what are the side effects of having this stuff strapped to you and take it off after a couple hours? Are you going to have vertigo or something? Like, what's that effect going to be, long-term or short-term? Like, to me, I don't know. I think so part of me says it could be cool to look around in a shooter. Part of me thinks that's going to be a big hassle, and there could be some side effects that people are not going to want to deal with. Like the Virtual Boy, you can't play for 10 minutes without getting a headache.
Yeah, I don't know what the technology is that I require, but I'm not even thinking of like the current headsets. I'm thinking of, you know, in the future, obviously not
the holodeck,
but like at some point, you know, there will be an immersive form of entertainment that does kind of take over the older form. And I don't think that's going to be a gimmick. That'll be here to stay. Headsets and all this crazy talk, yeah, that might pass.
At Gomer21XX, do either of you partake in alcohol? And if you do, what is your favorite alcoholic drink?
Oh, man. I can't even start with that sounding like a Lush. I was a bartender for 5 years. I can make a lot of really good drinks. I like bourbons. I like good beer. I like absinthe. I like martinis. I like martinis and Manhattans, beer. I don't like a lot of
Manhattans. My grandfather drank Manhattans.
And I can make a Manhattan.
That's like a dead drink that no one drinks.
No, on the East Coast, people drink them all the time. You can't find a person. Yes, you can't find a person out here to make a Manhattan.
I remember
girls even order that, or it's always martinis.
But martinis and Manhattans, I like my mixed drinks simple, not a lot of sweet and fruity stuff, and I love really good beer.
For the most part, if I can drink some lagers. I'm not like Stella Artois.
Pat likes skinny martinis or skinny margaritas.
I don't actually. I like regular margaritas. Okay. Or anything like, you know, without, not the fruity kind, the regular kind.
Yes. Tequila, Cointreau, and lime juice. Done.
Yeah, exactly. Or I just usually buy the mix in the store, mix it with tequila.
That's weird.
But anyway, it just gets the job done quickly. You know what I mean? That's what I do. Okay. Or vodka based drinks. I like clear alcohols that are smooth, and they don't give me hangovers at all. If I don't usually get drunk. I get drunk like once a year, and if I do, they don't give me hangovers. The only thing that makes me feel like shit is wine.
I love
because
wine.
All the impurities in it. Even if I drink like two glasses of wine, I'll feel like shit the next day, even if I was never drunk. It's just that's my body doesn't like that thing. I'm not a big wine fan. It's just like, and beer, I can't. It's funny. I'm out with Frank, and he's having a beer or two, and we have like nachos, for example. He's like, "Yeah, why don't you get a beer to sit on top of that?" For me, it's like that would be the worst thing I could possibly do. To him, that's like the top off to the food is having another beer.
For me, I
can't do that. To me, it fills up my tummy too much to have a beer while I'm eating. I usually don't mix. I don't like mixing beer with. If I'm gonna have a beer, it's usually before I eat. That's just me. I don't like usually having a burger and beer. I usually don't do that. That's just not me. But whatever. This is from Ed Helen. Hey, Helen. I care about my desert.
Howdy.
Is there anything you're looking forward to this upcoming year, whether it be games, movies, conventions, etc.? There's lots of movies. Captain America I'm excited about. I love Captain America. The new Spider-Man movie. Spidey and Captain, my favorite guys. You know, all conventions. SGC is going to be fun. Probably going to go to Con Bravo. Retropalooza in September. We have a certain wedding that I might be invited to.
Yes.
In October. Portland Retro Gaming Expo in October as well. That'll be fun. I think that's it for now. I'm probably missing one. Maybe CGE Classic Gaming Expo in Vegas. Yeah. And I'm going back home to Jersey. That'd be cool.
I'm definitely looking forward to getting married. I was looking forward to the reveal and the launch of Roland's new synthesizer line. I've got two of those pieces on the way. I'll see how those are. And I'm looking forward to... Comic-Con again.
Comic-Con. That's
looking forward to Comic-Con. I never get God sick of Comic-Con. And,
I always damage my M8, yeah?
I don't know that I'll have as much money to spend at Comic-Con this year as I usually do, but Comic-Con is something that I have yet to burn out on. I hear people whine and bitch and moan with their passes around their neck that they're getting tired of it. Well, it's like, well, why are you paying for it?
I hate that people are bitching about the ticket process where they made it the most fair it's ever been.
Right, in years.
So basically, Comic-Con, real quick, it used to be... Website, 7 a.m. Pacific time. That Saturday, you got to get online, keep clicking refresh, and get in. And being that, maybe because I'm closer to the servers on the West Coast, that's how I usually got my tickets. But people always complain, oh, I timed out. I couldn't get in. I thought I was in the waiting room, and I wasn't. So they change it to, okay, that's bullshit. You have 2 hours just to get into the waiting room. Then you're randomly assigned a number. It's the most fair system you can possibly get, because then... the server errors and all that shit's eliminated. People are still bitching because they didn't get tickets. Like, well, you should reward the people that are there first. No, that, what is this? Getting tickets to an AC/DC concert in 86? Yeah. It's like, what else do you want? People were bitching no matter what. I love seeing them bitch. I got 3 out of 4 tickets. So I didn't even get my 4th ticket. I don't have a Friday ticket now. But I'm not bitching. I'll probably get a Friday ticket, you know.
Pick this one.
A couple more.
Keep saying that.
Two more. There's actually only two more.
Okay.
This is from @CronNintendo. Who is the greatest intercontinental champion of all time? It's Honky Tonk Man, obviously. No, well, who do you think?
Fucking Macho Man Randy Savage.
Well, that's because he used to always say that, Honky Tonk Man.
Yeah, I know.
Who did I like as intercontinental champion? I love the Warriors' white belt. I always remember that white belt.
Yeah,
And they brought it back the past year when Cody Rhodes won it.
Mm-hmm.
They brought back the white old school belt.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was always nice to me. Still, the IC belt means almost nothing. The US belt means less than nothing since it hasn't been defended.
No, back then, the IC belt meant a lot. It was the launching point to your career. Now it means nothing.
Yeah, now it means nothing. The thing of
You can have an IC run and lose it and not go anywhere.
Now they give the IC belts to guys that give them that extra boost starting up. What's his name has it? Big E Langston has it, who's only been in the Federation for like a year and a half.
at most. And he's talented. He's a big body, like heavy lifter, but he actually can move around the ring. But they gave it to him, and it doesn't mean a damn thing.
Sure.
He doesn't even have a WrestleMania. He doesn't even have a feud. It's in a WrestleMania match. How disgusting is that for the IC belt? When it needs to be like just as big a match almost.
Okay.
And finally, this is from Swazi4. What are your favorite wrestling matches? Maybe Madden won't search himself this time. Let's talk about that real quick, what happened with Mark Madden a couple weeks ago. I forgot about that. So I forget how exactly it happened where Mark Madden, who it was, used to be, he's a talk show host now.
Yeah.
He's got probably a decent following, not the biggest talk show, but he used to be a color commentator during the dying years of the Russo era of WCW, like 99 and 2000.
Rough fucking stuff.
Really bad. And he was, I remember him being loud and obnoxious, wearing just loud shirts. It was after Bobby the Brain Heenan left, because he fucking hated WCW after a couple of years. And so, I forget how someone brought up Mark Madden. It was in one of, he responded to you.
Yeah, we were just talking on Twitter, and he responded to whoever was, he didn't respond to me, he responded to whoever asked me the question. He
brought up something about Mark Madden being just
annoying or something.
Annoying or something.
And so Mark Madden actually responds, and
he responded, but it was a subtweet, because he didn't go like at Mark Madden. It was just he searched for his name to show up, and he responded saying, "Well, I got a big radio show with all these viewers." And I responded, "What I say? Oh, 50." He says, "Like I have 50,000 subscribers," and I responded, "Ian, remind me when I get to that many number of subscribers, I'm not going to be searching for myself on Twitter."
Yeah,
it was just so pathetic and just like crying out for attention and to respond to any sort of criticism. And I was just like, shut the fuck up. Why, you have so many followers. You have a national radio show, or at least regional. Why are you responding to someone talking about you about one thing on Twitter? Like, why are you searching for yourself?
Anyways, to answer your question,
he's going to respond to this now when it's on YouTube.
Yeah, it would take me a long time to make up like an accurate top five, but off the top of my head, two of my favorite matches, one I've already mentioned on here a million times, is Steamboat Savage. The other one, though, that is a little lesser known and is really, really good, everyone should watch it, and if you have the network now, you can, is Eddie Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, Halloween Havoc 97. It's fantastic.
Is that the same Halloween Havoc as Malenko Jericho?
No, that's Gato Jericho. Gato Jericho was on that.
That was 98 then?
I think so.
Because that's supposedly, Jericho said the biggest pop he ever heard ever was Dave Malenko when he removed the mask as the mystery opponent. And if you go on YouTube.
If you go on YouTube,
the crowd is going ballistic.
Yeah.
No,
really, watch Mysterio Guerrero. It was like the second or third match on a really big card, but it's amazing.
God, I missed the undercards. Yeah. WCW. My favorite matches, real quick. Oh, man. I remember watching the first Clash of the Champions as a kid, and I remember the Sting Ric Flair match. It was like the 45-minute draw match, I think it was, or half-hour draw. And it ended with... And this is what I think I mentioned to you. This is like early 90s. What was that? Clash of the Champions, probably 92? Something like that? 91? Or 90, before he went to WWF. And this is when they were pushing Sting as the top star. And it cemented, I think it was the first Clash of the Champions, which was like a TBS show that was on like a few times a year, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of like almost pay-per-view quality. I remember watching it, and just Flair was hated, obviously. And then Sting, like, it went back and forth. And then, obviously, even though I wasn't familiar with WCW, I know winning the title was a big deal. And then it ended in the draw. The last 20 seconds, he had Flair and the Scorpion deathlock. And it's like, oh, and he held out. He didn't tap out. And it's like, oh, it was just very dramatic. You know, maybe that's not my favorite match, but I always remember that as my first sort of, really first time I kind of watched WCW and discovering kind of both Flair and Sting, I think. Because I think that's before I watched him in WWF, or maybe afterwards. But, that to me just stands out as a good match. I'll probably go back and watch that. They don't have Clash of the Champions on WWE Network, I don't think. They probably get it eventually.
Yeah.
Other than that, how about Bret Hart versus Stone Cold, WrestleMania 13?
Yeah.
That's probably a bigger one, right? Double turn. It's hard to pull off. You know, they had a great rivalry, Stone Cold. He always gave Bret Hart props he elevated, you know, Austin so much, Hart, just by working with him and everything.
Goldberg DDP.
I went back and watched that again, like last month. We was always talking about that. That's a really good match. A favorite? It's up there just because it's totally choreographed. Totally choreographed.
Yeah.
But it works because it plays to the strengths of both. The wrecking ball of Goldberg versus like the wily kind of veteran of DDP trying to survive.
I admittedly haven't seen it in a while. I just remember I just remember that DDP carried Goldberg to a pretty good match, and that I remember the spot that I called, like, days before watching it occurred. I was like, he's going to slip out of this jackhammer into the diamond cutter.
And when he did that, the crowd went nuts.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, maybe going back, it's not the best.
It's not the best, but at the time, it was...
Especially WCW at the time, it was probably a well...
That was Halloween Havoc 98.
Yeah, it was probably... Yeah, it was. It was probably the best... One of the better worked matches you saw Goldberg in. Let's put it
that
way.
Face versus face, which WCW, I think at the time, did not really do that much of for the title. And yeah, it was just good. It was obviously a placeholder for
Goldberg. Kept them both faces afterwards, too. They ended it without a turn.
Yeah, it was just like he was the next in line for the title. Yeah. DDP, I think he had been U.S. champ.
Yeah.
I think against Raven, he had the whole Raven thing against the Flock.
Yeah, I think he had held it for quite some time. But yeah,
he was. That kind of elevated DDP. He got the title the next year. He was like 3-time champion, I think, or 2-time world champ. DDP. I love DDP. One of my favorite wrestlers ever.
Same.
No, it was a really fun. The funny story about that match is that DDP tells that two funny things are about the match. If you go back and watch it, the first time Goldberg tries to spear DDP, he comes at him full speed. The thing about Goldberg is that he ended Bret Hart's career because he was a little bit too into it in the ring.
Right.
He was a little bit reckless. He was still sort of green. He'd only been wrestling for 2 years.
Yeah.
At this point. And so when he goes to spear DDP, who gets out of the way, but he's coming at him such full speed that DDP said later in the interview, if he would have hit me, he could not have killed me. Because he was really coming in. And when you watch it, he barely gets out of the way.
Doesn't Goldberg also end up knocking himself out on his feet?
That's the thing.
Yeah.
When he actually spears DDP, he does it so much that he knocks himself out.
Yeah.
And it probably hurt DDP too from how hard it was hit. So much so that when they did the spot, DDP was still out on his feet. When they did the spot, he said he reversed the jackhammer to the diamond cutter, that Goldberg kicks out just at 2 2¾. And DDP said he was pissed. He went to Goldberg. And I said, what the hell? Like, why did you kick out only at, like, right when it's 2? Why didn't you wait till 2½? The crowd went nuts. He said, Goldberg said, I didn't even know what was going on then. So right. There was a possibility he might not even kick that. It was pure instinct, you know. So if you imagine that would have been great. So anyway, that's what's going on for this CU podcast. 2 hours of fun times for everyone, huh?
On the dot.
On the freaking dot. I know people hate our wrestling chat. I love it. Some people love it, and we have an hour and a half of non-wrestling talk. So what's the difference,
actually,
right?
We probably did like an hour and 45 of non-wrestling talk.
So there you go.
We really kept it minimal this week for you.
One thing that we'll never get rid of: people bitching about. I was talking about wrestling, you know, some people love it, and people bitching about me getting a haircut. I got a haircut last week. This is it shorter now.
People bitching about hoods, people bitching about...
You've been hoodless.
Yeah, well, it's getting warmer.
And
people, here's the thing. Yeah, I wear a lot of hoodies, but people are under this assumption that I never take them off. I spend almost an entire summer without wearing a hoodie.
I just think it's interesting that people that when they see you online, they think that they are not entitled to tell you how to look, but if you're not fitting what... You're supposed to look like in their head, they get upset.
Yeah.
So people are upset I don't have short hair. I'm not going to have short hair anymore like I did with my sort of like Jersey punkish hair, if you can call it that, from 2008 to 2010. That's not going to happen again. I brought it back for the 5th anniversary video as a, you know, homage to that. You know, that's not going to happen. I just feel better with hair like this. Sorry.
It makes you look slimy.
Makes you look what?
Makes you look slimy.
This makes you look slimy?
No, when you have short hair.
I don't look good with short hair. I look younger, I think, but it doesn't fit in. Anyway.
Good night.
I'm not getting a haircut.
We love you.
For Ian Ferguson, my name is Pat Contry. This was the CU Podcast. Good night, everybody.